Welcome. We will begin this hearing. I'm anticipating that our members will start trickling in as they hear us over the television or radio. So this is the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee. Today we are prepared to hear from witnesses and testifiers about nuclear energy. And I would urge members not to get into debating it at this time, to ask clarifying statements. You certainly can question the testifiers. We want you to be as informed as possible. But we will preserve our debate on Thursday, and we intend to vote on Thursday also. So, first of all, the first group of testifiers, including question and answer, have until 3:45. So I urge you to, and there are three of you. The next group has 1 hour until 4:45, and the last group has until 5:30. So please try to maintain your time limits. And I'd like to call at this time Jared Heck. Maybe all three of you could come up. Jared Heck, Alan Barker, and David Boyd, I'm sorry. I think Mr. Heck will start. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jared Heck, and I represent the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. With me is Alan Barker. Alan and I work out of NRC Region 3, located near Chicago, which is responsible for the inspection and oversight of nuclear power plants in the state of Minnesota. We value the opportunity to provide you information, and thank you for inviting us. Alan and I would like to talk today about how the NRC regulates nuclear power plants, including how NRC reviews license applications for new reactors. But first, I'd like to give you a brief history of our agency, a summary of its independent regulatory authority, and an overview of its mission. Congress established the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1974 by splitting its predecessor agency, the Atomic Energy Commission, in two. The act that established the NRC, the Energy Reorganization Act, tasked our agency with licensing and regulating the nation's civilian use of nuclear materials to protect the public health and safety. Congress gave the responsibility for promoting nuclear power to a different agency, the Department of Energy. So our agency, the NRC, maintains an independent focus on nuclear safety and security, divorced from any activities that might be seen to promote or favor nuclear power. Accordingly, the NRC takes no position on the desirability of nuclear power. We're here today to provide the committee with an overview of how we regulate. NRC regulates by issuing licenses to users of nuclear material, including nuclear power plants, inspecting those who hold licenses, and taking enforcement action when a licensee fails to comply with NRC requirements. In a few minutes, Alan will talk about how NRC ensures safety through inspection and enforcement. But first, I'd like to give you a very broad overview of how NRC decides whether to issue a nuclear power plant license. There's much more information available about this process on our public website, in publicly available review plans, and in the Code of Federal Regulations. In the interest of time, I'll offer a thumbnail sketch. NRC does not construct or operate nuclear plants. It regulates those who do. And no new nuclear power plant can be built or operated without NRC approval. To gain that approval, a commercial utility or power generation company must first file an application. NRC staff then reviews it to determine whether the applicant has the technical, financial, and other qualifications required to construct and operate a plant safely. NRC's licensing review is rigorous, thorough, and transparent. Geologists, hydrologists, and other scientists will review how the construction and operation of a new nuclear plant would impact the air, water, land, and ecology at a proposed reactor site. Nuclear, mechanical, electrical, and other engineers would review the design of safety-related systems, structures, and components within the plant. Security experts would evaluate the applicant's plan for responding to threats, and plans for responding to emergencies would be examined in cooperation with other government agencies. Throughout, the NRC solicits public participation, offering hearings, meetings, and multiple other opportunities for active public comment and input. The NRC's licensing process is also consistent. Generally speaking, under the licensing process described in Part 52 of our regulations, which can be found in Title 10 of the Code of Federal Regulations, it should take the NRC staff between 2.5 to 3 years to complete its review of an application to construct and operate a new nuclear plant, assuming the application is of high quality and references an approved power plant design. After the staff's review is completed, the NRC's hearing process may require additional time. Applications to construct and operate designs that have not been already approved by NRC may take longer. If, after a full safety and environmental review, the application is found to meet all applicable safety, security, financial assurance, and other requirements, the NRC can be expected to issue a license. But our oversight does not end there. Regulation continues through a rigorous inspection and enforcement program carried out by professionals trained in engineering, health physics, security, and many other disciplines. I'll turn it over now to Alan for an overview of how NRC regulates operating reactors.
Madam Chairman, committee members, continue on with the existing power plants for regulatory oversight. For existing plants, NRC
Mr.
oversight.
Mr. Barker, just identify yourself for the record,
okay.
Please.
Alan Barker, U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Government Liaison Officer for Region 3.
Thank you.
For existing plants, NRC oversight occurs primarily through inspection and enforcement. The NRC inspection program assesses whether activities are properly conducted and equipment is properly maintained to ensure safe operations. Inspectors monitor plant activities, provide inspection findings to plant management, and conduct follow-up inspections to ensure that plant has taken appropriate corrective action. The NRC has full authority to take whatever action is necessary to protect public health and safety and may demand immediate licensee actions up to and including a plant shutdown. Reactor inspections are conducted primarily by resident and regional base inspectors. Under a program initiated in 1977, resident inspectors are stationed at each nuclear power plant. There are at least 2 resident inspectors assigned to each site. Resident inspectors provide firsthand observations and independent assessment of plant conditions and performance. Resident inspectors significantly increase the agency's on-site monitoring of plants and reduce the time to respond to events at the plant. The activity of the resident inspector is supplemented by engineers and specialists from the nearest regional office and headquarters staff who perform inspections in a wide variety of engineering and scientific disciplines. Region-based inspectors operate out of 4 regional offices located in or near Philadelphia, Atlanta, Chicago, and Dallas. In response to an event at a specific plant, the NRC may send a special team with staff from both NRC headquarters and regional offices. The region-based inspectors review plant security, emergency planning, radiation protection, environmental monitoring, periodic testing of plant components and systems, fire protection, construction activities, and other more specialized areas. Each plant also provides to the NRC data and measurements of safety performance. The data known as performance indicators are submitted quarterly by licensees to the NRC and indicate how well a plant is performing when measured against established thresholds for that area. The NRC uses inspection findings together with performance indicators to assess plant performance. And an assessment of each plant is posted to the NRC website. A plant that is not performing acceptably will be subject to additional inspection and scrutiny until performance improves. In closing, I want to highlight the importance of openness and transparency to our regulatory processes. All public meetings are posted on NRC webpage, with key ones being announced in press releases and in the Federal Register. Inspections and related findings are documented in public reports, which are made available to the public on the NRC webpage. Thank you. May we take your questions?
Are there questions of the testifiers? Senator Alcine?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had an opportunity to tour the Monticello nuclear plant, and the one thing, it's kind of like a meatpacking plant in the regards to, you know, there's federal inspectors. Do you kind of move them around so they don't get too friendly with the crew at one particular plant so that maybe personal relationships might stand in the way of them doing their job?
Yes.
Mr. Heck.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, the NRC does strive to maintain the objectivity of its inspectors. It's very important, particularly for the resident inspectors that Alan mentioned who are stationed at the plant. And typically, generally speaking, those inspectors will move every 5 to 7 years to help maintain that arm's length relationship.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either of the individuals from NRC. And this may not be a question which you're able to answer with great clarity, but my question is, does the NRC conduct either as an agency or through contract the assessment of Yucca Mountain in terms of its adequacy as a storage site, or is that some other agency?
Mr. Heck?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, the NRC is responsible for reviewing the Department of Energy's application to construct a repository at Yucca Mountain. So as with new nuclear plants, which we evaluate the safety, environmental, and other aspects or qualifications of an application, we would and currently are reviewing the same for Yucca Mountain. That is the NRC's charge under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and subsequent legislation.
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, then, Mr. Egg, and you suggest, is that then in progress or, insofar as you're aware, is that process going forward?
Mr. Heck?
Madam Chair, Senator, as you may be aware, the Department of Energy, who I'm not prepared to represent today, has announced its intention to withdraw the application. As we speak, I can't be certain that that has occurred. Okay. If and when the Department of Energy moves to withdraw its application, the NRC and parties to a hearing that is currently open would have the opportunity to respond to that motion to withdraw. But because those are future events, I'm limited in how much further I can comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either of our testifiers, I was just curious, in the last, say, 5 years, how many licenses have you issued? And maybe in the next 5 years, how many do you expect that would be issued in the next couple of years here?
Mr. Barker.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, we have not issued any operating license or license for power plant, new reactor, if that's what we're mm-hmm. talking about. Currently, we have 18 applications, which consist of 28 units. Some early construction done in Vogtle site for 2 units, early site permitting. But there's no way from a standpoint of maybe Mr. Heck could talk about when, if you're talking 5 years forward, if we're going to grant or do a license. The process now combines the construction permit and the operating license here in the process. So there has been allowing the early excavation of area in Georgia in Vogtle.
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, so this is sort of like a design build process where you approve a certain part of the process and then allow them to go the next phase. Is that how that works? Or, you know, if you're giving them permission to go to build a certain part of it, or how does that work?
Mr. Heck.
Madam Chair, Senator, there are two different licensing processes available to new applicants. And the process that I believe that's been used in the Vogtle site is the Part 52 process I alluded to in my remarks. And that process allows for early review of a site suitability as well as early review of a design application and includes something called a limited work authorization where the NRC may, prior to completing its full review of all of that questions presented by an application, may authorize limited construction activities such as excavation, backfill, pouring of foundations. So the complete answer is rather involved, and I would be happy to perhaps provide you additional information.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I might just follow
Senator
up.
Senator Dahl.
Does that mean that there's a possibility that a power plant could start putting some investments into a site, and at some future point you could stop the project and say you don't qualify for one of the other conditions that you're looking at? Is that possible?
Mr. Heck.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I want to give you a good answer. To give you the best answer, I'd really prefer the opportunity to go back and consult with some of the people who are more familiar with the Vogtle site specifically.
Okay. And one final question, if I might, Madam Chair, is that Mr. Heck, is of the applications, so there's 18 applications out there, are they all in states that currently have nuclear power generators?
Mr. Barker.
Madam Chair, Senator, I also have to go back and get the data where those are exactly at to provide a better informed
thank you.
Response to you.
Senator Dibble.
Just to be sure, those answers will be provided to the whole committee.
Yes. How soon do you think you can provide them?
Oh, Madam Chair, we should be able to provide those answers within a week's time, easily.
Could they be possibly
prior to Thursday?
To Thursday would be very helpful.
Madam Chair.
Of course.
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Youngbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess it was Mr. Heck that talked about the time frame of permitting. And you said something about 2.5 to 3 years if it's an already approved process. So on average, permits that you were working through today, what do you think the time frame from start to finish, from somebody starting the application process to approval of some of the newer generation technologies would be, you know, instead of the 2.5 to 3 years if it's approved? I'm assuming that not all these applications are approved technology, so can you give us a better guess, I guess?
Mr. Heck.
Senator and Madam Chair, it would add time. It's difficult to predict. The NRC is experiencing a number of proceedings currently where designs are referenced that had not been completed. The review of those at the time of completion. It's adding some time. But again, I think I can provide you a better answer if I'm permitted to consult.
Senator Youngbar.
Madam Chair and Mr. Heck, that would be great maybe if by in that package you could give us a little more detail on the, you know, where all these applications are and what process, when they started, and what part of the phase they're through. That would give us a great idea of how long this whole process could be. Thank you.
Okay. And Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Switching the conversation a little bit to the role of inspecting our plants, could you give us some examples of the types of problems you might identify when you inspect plants?
Mr. Barker.
Madam Chair, Senator, the inspections that are done by the resident staff would be in areas, for example, of component reliability, maintenance practices, maintaining equipment that can fully function, its safety function. The other one would be that is supported by the regional staff. As an example, there would be a problem identification and resolution where you look at how the problems are identified by the licensee, how they're corrected, and if actions are needed to prevent them. So it would be a matter of looking at over a two-year period to look at problems, how they're identified, do they understand where their problems are at, are they putting corrective actions in place to fully correct the issue, and does it repeat? Those would be some examples of some of the inspections that would be done both from our resident inspector staff and also regional base.
Senator Rama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you identified corrective issues here in Minnesota?
Mr. Barker.
Madam Chair, Senator, there are inspections done on Monticello and Prairie Island. The reports are documented issues that have been identified for those arenas in a problem identification resolution. And in each issue, each finding is looked at for significance. And based on its significant level, will allow us to judge if they need additional supplemental inspections or the status of their process and corrective actions. So we do that report every 2 years for both stations, Monticello and Prairie Island.
Senator Rama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give us examples of items that you've identified that need corrective action?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Barker.
I can give you not specific examples, but what I can do is also in the information will be given to you prior to Thursday, I can provide those reports, the latest reports that will document what we have on the document in the public realm to identify the issues that were identified and for the corrective action or the problem identification resolution inspection.
Senator Rama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Partly because I'm a layperson, and some of those reports are Greek to me. I'm hoping that you will distill that information so an ordinary layperson can understand what the citations were and what's been done to correct them.
Mr. Barker.
Madam Chair, Senator, I will distill those down, and we can go ahead and provide even some additional briefing on what the reports are and bring those into a level of understanding.
Thank you. I want to remind members that we're on a very tight schedule. And Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. I just read recently, just in the last few days, the state of Vermont or the Vermont legislature voted to shut down a nuclear plant. And as I understand it, I just read about it this in the paper, is that they were upset because there was some leaking tritium, maybe? And that someone from the plant had lied about it. And I'm just wondering why it got to that point, what the NRC's role was in a situation like that. What did they do about the problem? Do you know? I know this isn't your region, but.
Mr. Heck.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it would be best for you if I could get information from Region 1, which is the region that has oversight responsibility for Vermont Yankee.
Thank you. I would appreciate that, Madam Chair. And I have one other question, if I may.
Totally
different subject. I wanted to ask about uranium sources, and I assume that's something that you are involved in or knowledgeable about. Where, if we increase our use of nuclear power in the United States, what are the sources of uranium that we would be looking to for an increased use of nuclear power? Do you know where it would come from?
Senator Anderson, there might be some testifiers that could answer your question better later on.
Well, Madam Chair, I was hoping to get something that wasn't just from the industry perspective, if they have any expertise, but I can also ask that later.
Mr. Heck?
Madam Chair, Senator, as I said in some of my remarks, the NRC doesn't have a position favoring or opposed to nuclear, and that extends to, you know, which sources may be favorable, which regions, which options for additional uranium mining and might be available out there. So It's difficult for me to answer that question for those reasons. There currently is, I can say, the uranium mining and milling operations that exist or would come into being would be something that our agency would have to evaluate and review for safety and other concerns.
One last question, Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, I just really quickly follow up. So,
Senator Anderson,
if uranium was imported from overseas, would you have oversight over safety of that?
Mr. Heck?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm afraid you've asked a question beyond my ability to answer. It may depend. I know that some international agreements exist with regarding downblending of uranium, and I'm afraid I'm just beyond my expertise at this point.
Senator Sharon.
I had two questions, but I'll ask one and just ask you in your report that you're providing that when you're talking about various degrees of problems that are reported and then a resolution plan is made for that, if there's a way of distinguishing from mild to moderate to severe and what the patterns are for that, because I wouldn't be able to distinguish that if there isn't a system for saying this is mild, this is moderate, because I'd like to know the differential. And then my other question would be if you don't have a formal statement to this yet, but if Yucca is not available, are you able to talk about what funding options there will be for the long-term storage of spent waste in a state like Minnesota? For the obligations of the state to hold that without a solution at the federal level?
Mr. Heck?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think the answer is no. The NRC doesn't set or establish funding requirements for states or other localities regarding the disposal of waste. So perhaps we can, you know, and again, for anyone here who needs additional information, we'd be happy to, if you'd like us to reach out or you'd like to reach out to us, we can engage in more conversation.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. You may step back now, and Commissioner Boyd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, senators. I realized long ago that it's nice to be first. Some things I was going to talk about were covered by people more expert than I, so I will self-edit as I go along. In Minnesota, for integrated resource planning purposes, we have gas-fired plants available as baseload facilities for the near and foreseeable future based on our statutory situation. Development of technology like carbon capture and storage will be necessary for coal to return to the resource mix, and actually will be necessary for gas-fired plants as well if we intend to meet the goal of reducing greenhouse gases to 80% below 2005 levels by 2050. Clearly, in the last year or so, there's been a renewed discussion about nuclear plants as a low or no carbon baseload option, and I wanted to use my time to try and highlight some national level issues. I understand there are others who will cover some state level specifics for you. Clearly, spent fuel, as has been the recent conversation, is one of the most concerning issues in this discussion. And this topic at the federal level is guided by the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, as was alluded to earlier. That piece of federal legislation established a process and timeline for selecting, siting, constructing, and operating one or more repositories for permanent disposal of spent nuclear fuel, as well as high-level radioactive waste that might come from military applications. The Act, together with the standard contract between utilities and the Department of Energy, defines the federal obligation to take possession of and dispose of spent fuel. And these activities are funded by a fee levied on each kilowatt hour of electricity derived from nuclear plants. There's a long and storied, checkered history of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. It was enacted in 1982. In 1983, nine potential storage sites were identified. That 9 moved down to 3. In 1987, Congress amended the Nuclear Waste Policy Act to focus on just Yucca Mountain. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act demanded that the Department of Energy take possession of spent fuel by 1998. That date came and went, and thus came the first round of lawsuits for breach of contract between the utilities and the government. In essence, that was the beginning of our dry cask storage era, where the pools within the plants had exceeded capacity. There was nowhere to transport the fuel, and the dry casks came and went. And hence came the second opportunity for ratepayers to pay for fuel disposal. The first time was when the per kilowatt hour charge levied on their electricity. The second time was through the payment of the dry cask storage system. In 2002, Secretary of Energy announced the intent to select Yucca Mountain as the disposal site. The governor of Nevada objected to that, as was provided for in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. Congress had statutory authority to override the governor's concern and did so. And in July, President Bush signed into law the resolution that overturned that veto. In 2008, the license application for Yucca Mountain was submitted by the Department of Energy to those guys, to the NRC, and that review has been going on for some time. There are 104 active reactors in 31 states nationally. There are also 14 decommissioned nuclear facilities around the country. 10 of those still have waste on site, despite the fact that the plant is otherwise gone or mothballed. There are approximately 120 total sites when you consider the high-level waste from defense purposes. And in the notes I presented to you, there's a nice little map of Nevada for orientation purposes. Nevada, Las Vegas is down at the point. Yucca Mountain's about 90 miles northwest, in contact with the Nellis Air Force Base and with the Nevada nuclear test site. So now, some decades later, and $10 to $13 billion later, we've invested in the study of Yucca Mountain. Those are monies that came from ratepayers through the Nuclear Waste Fund. Most recently, the current administration has taken a series of positions with respect to nuclear energy. They've expressed support and encouragement for construction of new reactors as a route to yield baseload, low-carbon or no-carbon electricity. They have established loan guarantee programs through the Department of Energy. Some $54.5 billion in loan guarantees have been authorized. The first $8 billion were just announced for the site in Georgia, a coalition spearheaded by Southern Company. The in-service dates for those plants are projected to be 2016 and 2017 for the two additional units. The administration has also declared their intent to seek dismissal of the Yucca Mountain license application and to zero out funding for the program. So part of the answer to the question about the license review is that it is ongoing, but the Department of Energy will have no money to fund the continued review, and the intent is for the Department of Energy to withdraw their license application. Lastly, the administration has established a Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future as an alternative to the license application at Yucca Mountain to try and map out a path for managing used fuel and nuclear waste. The panel is a distinguished group. They're expected to report in 18 to 24 months on, among other things, the disposition of used fuel. The notes I have on new reactor applications says that there were 21 applications for 30 units. I may be wrong. Those applications have come over a multi-year period. They're in various states of review. And while the estimated costs of these new projects are very high, there are a number of studies on the actual cost of delivering electricity at the time of opening the plants that suggest that the electricity may very well still be cost competitive with other options that are put in at that point. Carbon policy is a significant variable in that scenario. If carbon costs are very high, then this type of technology will look more competitive in a price sense. If carbon costs are low, then it may not be quite as attractive. I would also note, I think there are going to be some significant workforce issues with respect to constructing these plants. We have essentially done little of this work for quite some time, and the kinds of specialized laborers who do the welding and whatnot are not numerous in this country, and that's actually an issue for the industry broadly. That industry is turning over. I mean the utility industry, not just the nuclear piece, but I think there'll be particular issues with constructing new nuclear plants. There are several pieces of pending legal action that resulted from, in response to the declaration of intent to withdraw the license application. Aiken County, South Carolina, has filed a legal action in the D.C. Court of Appeals. There's a group of individuals in Washington State who've also filed in the D.C. Court of Appeals. The South Carolina Attorney General has petitioned to intervene at the NRC in the license application proceeding. And the governor of South Carolina has also authorized the Attorney General in South Carolina to pursue all legal avenues available. There is some indication that action in the Fourth Circuit will come from them. And there's also, at this point, just talk about a Washington State intervention legally. Two other quick points before I leave. One, there are lots and lots of technology issues that could be talked about in conjunction with nuclear energy. One alternative that's been proposed to Yucca Mountain is centralized interim storage of spent fuel to take the fuel from these decommissioned sites and to take the casks from current operative sites, move them collectively to a smaller number of locations. That was the subject of a GAO report issued recently, and some pricing numbers, comparative pricing numbers, were included in that report. The notion is to find willing host communities that will participate. So that is one option that's out there. There's a lot of interest in different reactor technologies, whether they're reactors designed to use spent fuel more or less as it is, refabricate the fuel. Even, I don't know if you saw that recently, last few days, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about downsized, smaller nuclear plants that could be constructed, prefabricated at a factory, loaded on a truck or a train car, dragged to the site and placed something that's more like 150 megawatts instead of 1,000 megawatts. And being smaller and more modular, they don't have the same water requirements and cheaper to build and things like that. The spent fuel issue remains. That's unchanged in that kind of technology. That is not a technology that's been reviewed by the NRC. So in terms of the senator's question about timing, there would be a more lengthy review for a facility of that sort. And lastly, reprocessing is a constant topic of conversation. The spent fuel from our plants has 90-plus percent of its energy potential energy still inside of it. There's the French are doing some recycling, reprocessing of that fuel. There are concerns about extracting weapons-grade isotopes from that material. That's the proliferation concern that goes with that technology. I think the Secretary of Energy, who is very interested in reprocessing, is content to wait for studies that are at the bench level in national laboratories to come to fruition as alternative reprocessing technologies at some point in the future. And while perhaps this is not front and center in the mind, I think a word about the status of the Nuclear Waste Fund is important. The ratepayers of Minnesota have contributed directly nearly $400 million to the Nuclear Waste Fund. The interest that's accrued on that expenditure is another $300-plus million, so there's something in the neighborhood of $714 million that Minnesota ratepayers have sent to Washington to work on the spent fuel disposal issue. All told nationally, there's over $34 billion that's been sent to Washington. 10 to 13 billion of that has been spent analyzing Yucca Mountain, so the fund has somewhere, there's a piggy bank somewhere with an IOU for about $21 billion. The problem is it's not a discrete separate fund, it's commingled money, and that is a contentious issue. Several groups, including the national a union, if you will, of utility regulators and the industry itself have asked to have the Nuclear Waste Fund fee suspended. Those requests to Department of Energy have been rejected. There have also been a number of, as you all know, of proposals to escrow the waste fee funds, different states, Maine, Georgia, Michigan, Minnesota, over the years. There's been a certain There's certainly a desire to see the ratepayers protected and concerned about whether that's happening right now. I would note that, and I'm not a lawyer, that failure to deliver that money to the Treasury would constitute technically a breach of contract by the utility, so that's something that ought to be carefully considered before action of that sort is taken. With that, I think I'll stop, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Boyd. Are there any questions? Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Boyd, when you talk about this, shall we say, diverted funds at the federal level for the repository and the promise, do you know if Minnesota has any, and I don't know if the PUC would have to join in, does Minnesota have any pending litigation to sue the federal government for that diversion of those funds and the breach of contract on that repository?
Commissioner Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbar, no. We have not taken action or position. I think this is a topic that any number of groups, there's a question of who has standing in these matters, and this is where I'm off the deep end in terms of the legal issues. I think the Attorney General would certainly have a case to be made in this regard. We have not even inquired as of the moment about whether we have sufficient standing to pursue that topic.
On that point, Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Jungbar, it's my understanding that Xcel itself has done a suit of a partial breach of contract that's ongoing right now and is in the appeals process, as far as I understand. And Xcel could come up, I guess, if they wanted to clarify further.
Do you have another question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Two quick questions. Chair Boyd, you mentioned mothball sites. How many were those again?
14, I believe.
Thank you, and Madam Chair and Chair Boyd.
Senator Dahl.
Of those, there's still spent fuel on those sites. Do you know, is that something where there's 24-hour manned surveillance of those sites, or how do they? How does that work there in those
Commissioner
situations?
Commissioner Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, there is spent fuel on those sites. Some of those sites are still active with other reactors, so some of these sites are covered by the security that would be in place anyway, but it is absolutely the case that those sites have 24-hour security, and okay. From a development standpoint, those sites can't be used for any other purpose until that material is moved.
Okay, and Manager,
Senator
one last
Dahl.
Question. If you would know this, on the fees that we pay, the ratepayers are imposed with the nuclear waste fund and the decommissioning, all these things, Xcel has the two nuclear power plants. Are those fees imposed on the ratepayers for Xcel only, or are they spread out across all ratepayers across the state?
Commissioner Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, the nuclear waste fund fee only applies to the electricity that's generated, and I believe it extends to any ratepayer who would be potentially using that electricity. And since electrons are rather indiscriminate in the way they move, I assume it applies to all Xcel customers, but I will let someone from Xcel help me on that point. The second point about decommissioning fees are indeed separate. The money that's set aside is separate, and I don't know how that. I would assume it works the same way, but I'm not really sure if there is a distinction among, say, metro area customers who very clearly use that electricity from others in far flung reaches of their territory. Okay. My guess is that it's all customers only.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner or Chairman?
I answered all kinds of things.
A gentleman I know in Forest Lake did something like this. He took money from people for one purpose and used it for another. Now, he's in prison. I don't know if that applies here, but that's a lot of money to have charged everybody and not have a plan. Now, I understand they're going to pull the plug on the Yucca Mountain. Does it look like there's any realistic reason to think they're ever going to come up with a solution, or will they just keep the money, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, I think the frustration nationally over the use or lack of use of the fee is fairly universal. At this moment, there is no plan B, since the Yucca Mountain license application has been or is almost pulled. that task has now been assigned to this Blue Ribbon Commission. And as we have had interactions with members of the Department of Energy, almost every question we ask is answered by pointing to the Blue Ribbon Commission. The federal government still has a contractual and statutory obligation to deal with this material, and I will stand by the notion that they will fulfill that obligation. Mm. I'm not sure when, but I believe they will.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
The PUC does establish the size of a fund that's necessary for decommissioning in the state of Minnesota. And within that, you do make us, if I understand correctly, that decommissioning is not only for the facility that produces the power, but also for the maintenance of the cast storage after the plant itself is decommissioned. And that you have assumptions that you use in order to determine the size of that fund about how long after the decommissioning of the plant there will be storage to be obligated for Xcel to pay out of that fund. What is your assumption about that?
Chair Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'll have to look over my shoulder for a number of years type of assumption. I think it's a moving target right now. I think that in 19, when those plants were established, there was an expectation that material would be gone from the site by now. The new plants are probably going to have a contract that establishes an expectation that for 60 years past closure, the material stays on site, as opposed to the situation we have with contracts at the moment. I don't have an answer for you. I can check with my staff. I'd be happy to respond by Thursday. I don't know the exact number.
Thank you.
That fund, though, is monitored. It is reviewed periodically, and I'll just have to get back to you on a number.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Boyd. And Senator Koch, we started a few minutes late. We'll give you your full hour, so you have till 5 minutes to five.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I will speak quickly so we can move on to people with the real information. Madam Chair and members, before the committee today is Senate File 355. Senate File 355 is a bill to abolish the ban on new nuclear power plants in Minnesota. State law currently prohibits the Minnesota PUC from approving a certificate of need for construction of new nuclear power plants. It is time to allow clean, safe, and reliable new nuclear power plants to be considered when the Commission looks at how Minnesota's future energy needs will be met. What this bill is not. This bill is not a decision to This bill is deciding to repeal the prohibition. It is not a decision to construct a new nuclear power plant in Minnesota. Lifting the ban, however, would allow our electricity providers and the PUC to consider all options. It is not a preference for nuclear power. There's no expediting of the permitting process, and there's no automatic rate recovery for nuclear power in this bill. What this bill is a bipartisan issue. Today's testifiers in favor of the bill come from both sides of the aisle and everywhere in between. You all have a letter in your packet from Congressman Tim Walz and Congressman Eric Paulson in support of the bill. The exact language of this bill was amended onto the energy policy bill last session, just last year, and the vote was a very strong 42-24 on the Senate floor. The current Obama administration has taken a very positive stance on the nuclear power issue, and just a couple of weeks ago, President Obama announced a federal loan guarantee to construct two nuclear plants in the state of Georgia. This bill is also about jobs, and you're going to hear about that from business and labor. This bill is about putting nuclear on the menu of options for Minnesota's future energy needs. I appreciate the committee's willingness to hear and devote 2 days to this very important issue. I believe very strongly that Minnesota should not move into the future with one hand tied behind its back because it will not even consider the benefits that new nuclear power might bring to Minnesota. I think we should remove this prohibition. And now I'll ask the testifiers to speak.
Well, first, are there any questions of the author about the bill? Okay, thank you, Senator Koch. And the first is Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner of OES, Department of Commerce, and Marshall Cohen, Senior Director of State and Local Government Affairs for the Nuclear Energy Institute.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for having the opportunity to testify here. in the interest of time and because everything I say eats into our hour, I'll just begin very quickly by identifying myself. I'm Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, Director of the Office of Energy Security, and the state's Acting Reliability Administrator. With me today, I have Vincent Chavez from my office. He's a staff person, works for me, and he's going to talk a little bit about what our reliability-related concerns are going forward. But in front of you, Senators, you have a packet that Mr. Chavez put together. We hope that provides useful background information on the industry, both here in Minnesota, across the nation, and around the world. Addresses a number of questions that came up when this bill was heard in the other body last year. Instead of getting into all that detail, I'll just invite Mr. Chavez to talk about the future of our baseload energy production in the state.
Mr. Chavez.
Madam Chair, Senators, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Vincent Chavez, representing the Minnesota Office of Energy Security. I'll just point to one thing, and that's 2034, the time and place 24 years in advance. Why is 2034 important at all? Our portfolio blend to generate electric generation is changing, and it will continue to change. We've seen coal decrease as a portion of our capacity from 60% to approximately 43% between 1990 and 2006. The nuclear portion approximately decreasing from 16 to 13%. Natural gas actually increasing from 4% to 28% of our portfolio. However, what is important is that there'll come a time, and the time is 2034, where 60% of your coal plants, your coal fleet, will be over 60 years old. Coal plants keep burning. They're reliable. They burn at a certain rate. They emit carbon emission. But more importantly, in 2034, the renewal licenses that are now being exercised by our utility, Xcel, for the Monticello and Prairie Island plants will expire. Once again, what are we going to do in 2034? Energy efficiency, renewable energy will help. They'll help meet our increasing demand. But when we hit 2034, we're going to have to think about baseload that is currently serving our current demand. What are we going to do there? 2034. The clock is on.
So, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Glahn.
So the bottom line is we have an aging fleet of baseload coal and nuclear plants. I know 2034 sounds like a lifetime ahead, but given the long-range planning our utilities do and the long lead time that new facilities take, I hate to say it, but it'll be here before we know it. Now, not I or others may not make it to that age, but I think we owe it to our descendants to plan for an infrastructure that'll do them as well into the 21st century as we've experienced in the 20th and into the 21st. So with that, Madam Chair, questions.
Any questions or comments? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chavez, the current power plants that we have now, the nuclear plants, they were originally scheduled for like a 20 or 30-year license. Is that correct?
It's,
or 40?
It's,
I don't know.
I believe it was
Mr.
a 20-year license. Oh, Madam Chair, Senator, I believe it was a 20-year license.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Chavez, those have been extended already once, yes?
They are
Mr.
currently, they have been, one has been extended formally, the other one is still under review.
And finally, Madam Chair,
Senator
Mr.
Dunn.
Chavez, if the NRC and everyone is doing the jobs that they're supposed to do in Xcel as far as maintaining and the plants that we currently have, there's a good possibility that they could get another extension of additional 20 years. Is that correct, or don't you have, do you know if that answer?
I have no knowledge
Mr.
of that.
Chavez.
It would be pure speculation.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I'm aware that the utilities that file resource plans, none of them have projected baseload needs before 2024. That's as far out as their plans go. And it sounds like you're saying that our baseload needs start in 2034. And so, Madam Chair, I'm just a little surprised that we've had so much discussion about the pressing, urgent need to repeal this nuclear moratorium for the year 2034?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I do not believe that is correct.
Deputy Commissioner.
I believe our state's utilities have identified baseload needs in the next few years. They believe that they can meet it either through uprates of existing plants or through purchases of contracts from other utilities, and they can muddle through for the next few years. I think you're recalling our model, which we simultaneously solved a huge equation and said, okay, in 2024, we're going to put in a 500-megawatt coal plant. That doesn't mean the need doesn't arise until the year 2024. The year arises much earlier than that. It's just the output of one particular scenario and one particular model. So I don't think it's fair to say that this is much ado about nothing for decades in advance. I really want to leave the Senate with one impression from our testimony is we have a pressing problem, and just like a lot of other problems we have pressing in front of us today, that the farther in the future we push this, the more we'll regret it going forward.
Well, Deputy Commissioner, it may be that we need to start looking into the future for our baseload needs, but we clearly have gotten a message that baseload is not needed before 2024.
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to provide you with the results of all the IRPs with the timings. I have a spreadsheet on my computer that says this year, this utility, how many megawatts of baseload they need for the next 15 years.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to say what you did, that the utilities have not, in their planning out to 2024, none of them have proposed that they would need a new nuclear plant or a new coal plant. And so it just seems to me we need to kind of cool off on this urgency thing, because we're not talking about an urgent need. Yes, we're talking about very, very long-term future issues.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, not to belabor the point, but as a point of fact, in the integrated resource plans, we do not allow our utilities to propose a nuclear plant because of the moratorium.
Having said that, Deputy Commissioner, there has not been a request for new baseload.
Madam Chair, I do not believe that any utility in the state of Minnesota has filed an application at the NRC. That is correct.
New baseload, and any type of baseload.
Madam Chair, I would encourage you to review the spreadsheet and come to your own conclusion.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair. And just kind of on the same point, what I most worry about and think about, of course, is rushing into this and what the implications of rushing in are. I mean, is it true that there is nothing that stops a utility like Xcel or any other utility from thinking about, considering, you know, conducting some inquiry into adding nuclear power to their portfolio? Is there anything that stops them from thinking about it, talking to themselves about it, talking to other people about it? I'm talking about filing a resource plan, but.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, consistent with the First Amendment, I don't think there's anything prohibiting a utility from considering anything or doing feasibility. You'd have to ask them whether they've run their own scenarios. We ran a scenario in our resource assessment, which I shared with the committee earlier this term. But I would just, I guess I would take issue a little bit with the characterization that we're rushing into anything. I feel just the opposite.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, the dynamic and the impression that's been attempted to be given here, earlier testifier from your own office, certainly the tone and tenor of this debate is, we're under the gun and we got to lift this moratorium. It's a fact that if we're going to address all of our aging coal with nuclear power plants. I think the presentation from Commissioner Boyd earlier that you know, this is going to be a relatively inexpensive proposition wouldn't actually be true because a market would be created. The market dynamic, the market forces are such that costs to build, construct, you know, the availability of putting these sorts of generation sources online, the market's just not there right now.
Madam?
So the material, the generators, the construction, et cetera, it's going to drive costs up significantly. We may have the capacity in this country to build a couple of these things, but we can't build
but
a ton of
Madam,
them really
again,
fast.
At this time, I'd like us not to debate the issue, just ask clarifying questions as much as possible.
Thank Senator you, Madam Cole. Chair and Senator Dibble. We will have testifiers that will address that issue as well. So,
And I'm assuming the Deputy Commissioner will be around on Thursday if we need to ask further questions regarding that, too. Okay. Thank you. Next speaker is Marshall Cohen. I'm sorry. Senator Murphy, did you have a question? I didn't see you there.
Well, Madam Chair, I did have a question for Mr. Chavez. If his study had included the electrification of the automobile industry, since that's where about half of the carbon loading comes from, I was just wondering if he'd...
I'm wondering, Mr. Chavez, could you respond to that?
It's okay, Ben.
Madam Chair, Senator, not specifically. Okay.
Madam Chair, I have information.
Senator Dibble.
But that's just not true. We can take advantage of existing base load that occurs generation in the evening, and there wouldn't be any addition to our carbon footprint by the electrification of the automobiles.
Okay.
Well,
Senator,
Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
That point could be debated, too.
Okay, we'll debate it Thursday.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got an hour here.
Marshall Cohen.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Senator Solon, Senator Dole, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Cohen, and I'm with the Nuclear Energy Institute in Washington, D.C., and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on the issue before you, and thank Senator Koch for the invitation to do so. The Nuclear Energy Institute is the policy organization for the nuclear industry in the United States, and we have about 350 members, all of whom are engaged in the commercial production of electricity through the nuclear process, be it the utilities who provide the direct reactors, the supply manufacturing chain, the universities who train nuclear workers and nuclear engineers, and anyone else that may have some relationship to what we do. Senators, I'd like to start this afternoon with the following statement. Nuclear energy remains our largest source of fuel that produces no carbon emissions. To meet our growing energy needs and prevent the worst consequences of climate change, we'll need to increase our supply of nuclear power. It's that simple. Now, those are not my words. And those are not the words of the Nuclear Energy Institute, nor of anybody in our industry. Those are the words 2 weeks ago of the President of the United States, Barack Obama, when he was, as was mentioned by Commissioner Boyd, I believe, authorizing a federal loan guarantee for what will be the first new nuclear reactors to be built in the United States in 30 years. These reactors will be built in Georgia. They will bring over 3,000 construction jobs, 800 permanent, high-paying jobs to that state and those communities. In addition, they will significantly contribute to Georgia's ability to meet their clean air goals and baseload electricity demand in the coming decades as well. These are exciting and yet challenging times for our industry, and I commend Senator Koch and her colleagues for presenting this legislation to you and for offering to the citizens of Minnesota a decision on allowing the option of new nuclear reactors in your state to become just that, an option. And that option, I believe, is really the most important consideration for you when you look at Senate Bill 355. Because if you vote for Senate Bill 355, what you're doing is allowing Minnesota citizens, regulators, and policymakers the option of considering new nuclear to be part of how you address your future energy, clean air, and economic challenges and needs. Today, you will no doubt hear all the usual pro and con nuclear issues, the ideological battle that too often gets in the way of what repealing this moratorium really means, in our view, and what it does not mean. And it kind of relative to the discussion, I will call it debate, the discussion that just took place. There is not a nuclear reactor sitting on a barge in Lake Superior, nor on a flatbed truck in Fargo waiting to come in and be plopped right down the day after this moratorium is passed. It simply doesn't work that way. But there is now a convergence in the United States recognizing that our requirements to meet clean air goals, our future demands for electricity, and the demands of our economy to create new clean energy technology jobs leads us to nuclear energy being seen, as the President said, as his Secretary of Energy has said, and as his top White House energy advisor from the environmental community, Carol Browner, has said, nuclear has to be an essential part of the answer. In Minnesota, however, right now, you are unable to have a conversation about that because you have this wall up, you have this moratorium. Some will likely argue that you could have those conversations in face and with this moratorium in place. But consider, the conversation you want to have, in my judgment, is not an ideological one. You've had those and you'll likely have them again today, but a practical one. Just what might be the specifics of a new proposed reactor for Minnesota in the sense of the timetable? What energy demands, baseload power needs, will you need to meet, and when, and how would it fit into that? How exactly will the used fuel be managed and handled, and what, in light of what's going on in Washington with the Blue Ribbon Commission, what will be the United States' position, and what will they be doing with respect to responding to all the issues you've heard with respect to used fuel? How many jobs will be produced? How much local and state tax revenue will come out of it? What other economic impact will there be? What impact on electric rates will it have compared to other possible sources of new electricity to meet your needs? And, of course, what impact will it have on your needs, desires, and requirements to meet clean air and carbon goals for now and future generations? And I would argue that, in light of the discussion that just took place, you really are not in a position to judge those things because you do not have a proposal in front of you. And the day after this moratorium, should it come down, you probably won't have a proposal in front of you either. And in fact, you may have at some point in the future, should they make that business decision, you may have a proposal from Xcel, I don't know. But you also may have a proposal from somebody else because there are companies in this country who are looking to develop new nuclear facilities in states where they may not currently operate. The only way you have those conversations is in the context of one of those companies being interested in building a facility here. As long as you have that moratorium, you will not have that opportunity to know exactly what it means in the light of all the issues in front of you. But also recognize that this incredible convergence around the United States has developed strong bipartisan public and political support for bringing on a new generation of nuclear energy. It starts with the President, as I said. It goes through both parties of Congress, evidenced right here by the letter you have from Congressman Waltz and Paulson. And it goes through newspaper editorials that range from the New York Times to the Bemidji Pioneer. It goes through the support that you'll hear shortly from both business and labor, something that many issues in this country aren't able to produce, but the nuclear energy can, and you will see that. A number of states have enacted laws to encourage the development of new nuclear reactors. And last but certainly not least, there is consistent, strong public support for new nuclear in this country. There is 50-60+% support across the board by the public. And in those communities where the reactors, the current fleet of reactors, sit, we find consistently over 70-75% support for building new reactors on those sites. So we believe this means that there will be new nuclear reactors built in the United States. They're moving dirt at the Georgia project. My numbers, everybody has their numbers. My numbers are 13 companies with applications for 22 reactors, so you now have three sets of numbers in front of you. nothing more to say on that. The President has asked Congress to triple the amount of loan guarantee volume available to support new nuclear plants. And let me tell you, because you may hear otherwise, that the recipients of these loan guarantees, the borrower, if you will, pay all the costs, including a credit subsidy fee. And this will be and is the only loan guarantee program that the United States government offers where this takes place. There are no costs to the taxpayers in this loan guarantee program. So back to the conversation that Minnesota might want to have. Between the processes used by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, some of which you heard about today, and the processes used here in Minnesota, there's ample opportunity for not only state regulatory involvement, but citizen participation in the decisions that will determine whether a new nuclear reactor can be built here. So repealing the moratorium in no way guarantees that a reactor will ever be built. Continuing the moratorium does guarantee that your citizens never have the opportunity to participate in that decision. The state has ample mechanisms to block any nuclear power, any power plant construction, should it so choose. So a new nuclear reactor will not be built in Minnesota unless Minnesota wants one to be built. Let me quickly discuss several other items you've heard a little bit about, and I know that may be on your mind. First of all, used fuel. Used fuel at Prairie Island and every other site where it is maintained and stored in this country is safely managed and stored. The industry, our industry, is opposed to the actions pending in Washington with respect to Yucca Mountain, but that is a political reality. We have developed and are implementing, if the best we can in light of what goes on in Washington, a three-part strategy that will be recommended to the Blue Ribbon Commission studying this issue. The first part of that strategy is, in fact, to develop interim centralized storage facilities. You heard mention of some of these activities before. I happen to spend the other half of my life working on this issue, and I can tell you that there are communities in the United States that have stepped forward and working with us and with industry, industrial companies, that are very interested in hosting and building interim storage facilities where the fuel from Minnesota and a whole lot of other places can be moved sometime in the future. It's not a done deal because it requires some actions by Congress with respect to the Department of Energy and with respect to some funding aspects, but we are working on the ability to develop private NRC-licensed interim storage facilities. And I believe that if we can get the support of this through the Blue Ribbon Commission, and given the makeup of that commission, I think that is hopeful that we can move forward with that while the other two pieces of what the country needs to do get underway. One, the second piece is the reprocessing, what we call closing the fuel cycle. It's very clear in our minds that a primary element of the Blue Ribbon Commission will be to develop the guidelines for doing the research and development on reprocessing used nuclear fuel. So what, and frankly, Secretary Chu has stated that he is not content with the current processes that are used in other parts of the world, and that he wants the United States to move ahead with the research and development for new technologies. So I think you will see the Blue Ribbon Commission come out with some recommendations for that, which will guide the country in how reprocessing may take place in the context of being proliferation resistant, and also in the same context then the issue of what a final repository might look like, what might be necessary for a final repository. Because given the state of that commission and what its charge is, no one can really answer those questions now, and the arguments to be made about reprocessing are maybe moot is too strong a word, but you have to put them on hold until we see what direction that's going to go. So that is what the industry believes is important to begin interim storage, close the argument, begin to develop the right kind of reprocessing, and develop a final repository for what's left. It is the federal government's responsibility. They were supposed to take possession of this fuel in 1998, and we all, as well as anybody else, are waiting for that to happen. We, as was mentioned, we recommended that the waste fee being mentioned not be collected any further. We sent a letter, a strong letter, to the Secretary of Energy months and months ago. That was rejected. Remains to be seen now what will happen on that. And as also was mentioned, there are beginning to be some legal discussions and actions taking place in Washington with respect to the Yucca Mountain application. One or two other quick issues, new reactor designs. Most likely, absolutely, any reactor to be built going forward will have to be designed that is certified by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Two designs have been certified, three are pending, and that means that the next coming fleet will have some different appearances with respect to the old fleet. And in addition, those designs have a number of new technological aspects to them, which I'm not qualified to answer, so please, but we can get you information on that. I have included a great deal of information in the packet that I hope you have received in front of you. Our industry believes in being open and being honest and being transparent. We believe very strongly in the importance of working with state and local and federal officials at every aspect to make sure that your issues are answered, your questions are answered, and you have the information you want. And I thank you again for the opportunity to speak and be happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Cohen, could you say more about, did you say production tax credits or construction?
Don't think I said either. The federal government is considering investment tax credits and manufacturing tax credits to help the suppliers of materials to the nuclear industry.
Okay. I thought you said there were some tax credits that would prevent the ratepayers from being affected.
Oh, no. Madam Chairman, no. I'm sorry.
I hear that.
Maybe the loan guarantees.
Madam Chairman, I did discuss loan guarantees that are being awarded, and the state of Georgia has enacted some legislation to also support the construction, which has reduced the cost of their reactors by about $2 billion. But that's through expedited rate collection and then lower rates going forward type of process, construction work in progress legislation, not on the tax side.
Okay, but aren't there just a limited number of those construction?
Madam Chairman, there are about half a dozen states that have enacted those kinds of bills.
And they're up to, okay. So they're a state tax,
Yes, Madam Chairman, states are enacting legislation to help the support the financing in various ways, and which some companies are saying if they can get that in place, whether or not they get loan guarantees, they can move forward. Southern Company did say that, but Southern Company in the end is getting the first loan guarantees as well.
So maybe the ratepayers, but the taxpayers would be affected.
The ratepayers will have be participating, but because these are plants that are going to run for 40 to 60 years, the deal is that the cost is lower because of that upfront support for construction work and the interest costs. So in the end, the cost of those plants in Georgia is down $2 billion, and that will be reflected ultimately longer term over the rates. So it will come back.
Any further questions for the speaker? Senator Anderson, and then Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cohen. You rattled off a long list of questions, and you said we're not going to be able to answer those now unless we lift this moratorium. And honestly, I thought that's why we were having hearings. I think we really do need to answer those questions before we decide to lift the moratorium, and that's exactly what I had hoped that we would be getting at, because in 94, when we put the moratorium in place, it was because there wasn't a permanent waste solution. And so that's obviously that problem still hasn't been solved. And so we need to know that there's other compelling reasons. And I guess, so let me just ask two questions about some of the things that you touched on but didn't really answer. One is about the costs. And as I understand it, in Georgia and Florida, the nuclear industry is requiring that ratepayers pay up front for the construction, that the rates, and I've read, you know, anywhere from $5 or $6 to $9 a month, they have to start paying more in rates now before the plant is actually built and producing electricity. And that is unprecedented. I don't believe I've seen anything like that before. Is that kind of the new normal that we'll be seeing with nuclear plants, that there'll have to be upfront payments by ratepayers, rate increases before the plants are even built?
Madam Chairman, Senator Anderson, no. That's mischaracterized, if I may. In those two states, the state legislature enacted legislation to enable someone interested in constructing a new power plant to apply to the Public Utilities Commission for the ability to collect some upfront costs for the interest on the construction cost in order to lower the overall cost of the construction. And so the decisions to allow that are based on complicated application, financial work being provided by the company, guarantees, support provided by the companies, and a decision by the regulatory body of the state to say yes or no. So your statement was, does the nuclear industry require that? Absolutely not. That was something that was made possible by those two states. So that is a state-by-state decision. These plants are expensive. We know that. We understand that. We're upfront about that. There's no question. We think that the cost is worth it because when you turn the switch, they're going to run 40 to 60 years at very low cost, base load 24-hour, 7 electricity. So the question is, how do we make sure that companies that have a market value of $10, $15, $20 billion can build an $8, $9, $10 billion pair of reactors, new reactors, if they want to, because they're betting the company. These are serious business decisions. So that the loan guarantee program, which the federal government enacted in 2005, and it took till 2010 for the first one just 2 weeks ago to be awarded, that is to provide some support and confidence for the financial community and for Wall Street that they can go ahead and get involved in the financing of the reactors because there is that loan guarantee. But it's not the time that takes place, the due diligence that's done by the Federal Department of Energy and Wall Street on these things is some pretty serious activity, and it is not done lightly. But there's no requirement placed on ratepayers. Ultimately, in the regulated states, there will be involvement by the PUC and the ratepayers for you know, the cost of the electricity. That's the way the process works.
Senator, well, Madam Chair, Anderson. I think what you're saying, obviously the regulators would have to agree to this, but I think what you're confirming is that's what the industry would expect if they came to Minnesota and wanted to build a plant, that we would pay up front, ratepayers would be required to pay up front before they'd consider building here.
Madam Chair, Senator, again, with all due respect, no. You cannot characterize what the industry will expect. You're making generalizations with all due respect, which goes back to the original point. You don't know how a proposed plant in Minnesota will be proposed to be financed. You don't know what the cost will be, what the design of the reactor will be, how the company proposes to develop those costs, get that support, and what the rate will be. And I'll tell you that you won't know that because it is an expensive proposition for these companies to put those kinds of things together, to put an application together to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's millions of dollars. It's a lot of work. And so long as there is a moratorium here, no one's going to have the slightest interest to say, let's really dig in and talk to you about, well, here's what we think and how would this work? Because why would they do that so long as this moratorium is in place? That is not a practical thing that works with the business. So it's not the industry, it's not fair to say the industry is saying, you have to let a reactor build because we can collect from the ratepayers. I mean, you have to look at the specific proposal, and what's proposed here may be very different than what's proposed in Georgia.
Mr. Cohen, I urge you to keep your remarks brief so the rest of your testifiers can also be heard.
No, I understand.
Madam Chair, Anderson, is there more? I just want to ask I think we're arguing circles here, but on that issue, let me ask about the uranium. If we were to increase the amount of nuclear power produced in the United States, what are the main sources of uranium that we would have to go to?
Mr. Cohen.
Madam Chair, Senator, uranium primarily comes, there is some uranium in the United States, primarily comes from Canada and a number of other places. You have a gentleman here who brings that uranium in from a lot of places. He can answer that far better than I can. He will give you that information.
Madam Chair, will he be testifying?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, he will be.
And who is that?
Scott Melby.
Okay, I'll ask him. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll keep it brief. But Mr. Cohen, my question is about the Blue Ribbon Commission, and it appears to me, if I can summarize what I received from you, is that you're very confident about the report, that it'll be non-biased and very thorough, and the recommendations that come from this report will be not necessarily the Bible, but would be adhered to. Is there going to be a middle term reporting? I know it's 18 to 24 months that this commission is going to be meeting, so is there going to be some kind of report midterm?
Madam Chairman, Senator,
it's
a good question. All we know is sort of what you know, which is that the directive is a first report in 18 months, a final report in 24 months. They are having their first hearing. I just learned this morning. I think it's March 25th, so they are getting underway. They have developed some assignments of full-time staff within DOE, so we're encouraged that they are going to get this thing moving. We suspect there'll be some learning curve and some tours and trips to see various things before they get down to where they're going in discussions, and we don't know yet what the public process will be for input.
Okay, Senator Romo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go to your second step in dealing with the waste, and you talked about the possibility that in the future that the reprocessing of nuclear waste might be less likely to multiply the amount of waste we have. Do you have any sense of when we'll understand what that might be, and how far along are we in that
study?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's the magic question. Reprocessing takes place in other parts of the world. The French do it, have been doing it for a long time, the Areva technology. The Japanese do it, the British do it. Some others are beginning to do it. The United States has consistently, for 30 years, resisted doing it because that process produces pure plutonium, which is something the bad guys want, and we don't want the bad guys to have. That is why Secretary Chu has said he doesn't support the current process technology. He wants to encourage research and development for new technologies. The people in our organization who are experts on this say that there are various technologies that have been researched, looked at by the national labs. There are various ideas from some of the companies for new steps in the technology. But I think we are going to have to wait and see how the Blue Ribbon Commission comes out with and what guidelines they set for the research of that to go forward, because it's going to be very expensive. Okay. It's going to take a long time.
Senator Romo.
So it will be a long time before we really know how we're going to deal with that.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's going to be a while, I think, yes.
Thank you. Senator Dahl. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question. Mr. Cohen, how many other states have moratoriums on the certificate of need process for nuclear?
Madam Chair, Senator, there are about 10 states with a moratorium.
Yeah, thank you. And one follow-up question, if I might. In the past 20 years, how many states have actually constructed, or how many new nuclear plants have been constructed in the last 20 years?
Madam Chair, Senator, there haven't been any. That's why the significance of the announcement that the Vogtle plant in Georgia has got the loan guarantee. They're moving dirt through an early site permit by the NRC. We expect they will be the first new ones in 3 decades or so.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is building on a question that Senator Dahl asked earlier. Now, these 104 nuclear power plants in the country that are entering, coming to the end of their existing permits, do we expect that those are going to be decommissioned, or do we expect that those are going to be repermitted and in operation in perpetuity?
Madam Chair, Senator, over half of those have already been relicensed. The great majority are expecting to be relicensed. I couldn't give you an absolute number that will be, but you will see probably 80-90% of that fleet relicensed for another 20 years. There are some in the industry, I'm not an engineer or a physicist, there are some who think they could even go beyond that, but for the moment, a significant number will continue.
Well, Senator Dibble.
This is a long-term prospect, I think, a 40-year prospect of significant conversion to nuclear power. Some is going to, dealing with these old plants as well as dealing with old coal plants. I mean, it's been represented that perhaps some of these plants can last forever if we take good enough care of them. Is that true or
Mr.
Or
Cohen?
Not?
Madam Chairman, Senator, well, again, I'm not an engineer. I know that these 40-year-old plants are not 40-year-old plants. There are outages. There are constant replacement of parts and so forth. And, the way that the NRC rigorously monitors them assures that they're not just kind of falling apart. So I can't comment on how long, ultimately long, but there is confidence through the NRC process that 60 years, if you meet the various requirements of the NRC, 60 years is clearly something that will happen.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cohen.
Thank you very much.
At this time, I'm going to change the schedule because we have a speaker that needs to be out of here before 5 o'clock. And so I'm going to call on Lisa Ledwidge.
Thank you very much. My name's Lisa Ledwidge. I represent the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. And I do have 3 handouts. I don't know if there is a page who could help me. I would really appreciate that. Hand them out to the committee, please. Chair Pretner Solon and members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for allowing me to testify, allowing me to fit in early. I teach a class and they're giving presentations tonight, so I really need to be there and I really appreciate your help. I today am speaking on behalf of Arjun Makajani. He is the president of the institute where I work. We're based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. I live here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm the outreach director, and we are a nonprofit technical institute that provides the public and policymakers with thoughtful, clear, and sound scientific and technical studies on a wide range of issues, including energy. Arjun Makajani, whom I'm testifying on behalf of and whom I prepared this testimony with, has a distinguished record of doing studies on energy issues and generally of doing science in the public interest. His record was recognized in 2004, for instance, when he was elected fellow of the American Physical Society, which is an honor bestowed on a very small percentage of its members. We'd like to talk with you about some considerations on the economics and waste issues associated with nuclear power that I hope will inform your vote on the bill before you. In 2007, Jeffrey Immelt, who is the CEO of General Electric, was quoted in the Financial Times, and I quote, "If you were a utility CEO and looked at your world today, you would do just gas and wind. You would say there are easier to site, digestible today, and I don't have to bet my company on any of this stuff. You would never do nuclear. The economics are overwhelming," unquote. Mr. Immelt was arguing for loan guarantees for nuclear power because only nuclear power requires betting a whole company, if not more, on the success of a project. It illustrates why Wall Street won't touch nuclear reactor projects with a 10-foot pole. They are reminders of the history of cost overruns, rate hikes, and bond defaults of the 1980s that led Forbes magazine to call nuclear power, quote, "the largest managerial disaster in business history," unquote. The problems that Minnesota could face if it lifts its moratorium and starts down the nuclear road can be illustrated best by what is happening right now in places like Florida and San Antonio, Texas. In Florida, two utilities, Progress Energy and Florida Power and Light, have announced nuclear projects of two reactors each. Progress Energy's current market capitalization is less than the $17 billion price tag of its nuclear project. It's betting far more than the company. Florida Power and Light is one of the largest private electric utilities in the United States and has a market capitalization of about $20 billion, which is not much more than the $14 billion cost estimate of its nuclear project, not including unforeseen delays and cost escalations, which have been common in the past. Since Wall Street won't finance these projects, the Florida State Legislature has allowed both utilities to collect money in advance from ratepayers for the projects without any promise that the projects will be completed or that ratepayers will get any electricity from them. This is like giving an advance to a builder for a house without any assurance that he'll build the house or give you the keys. Florida ratepayers began their revolt almost as soon as the utilities started collecting money for these projects. Large businesses and industries in Florida and also in Georgia, where this is happening, oppose these advance payments. And there's a Washington Post article that was published today that is in front of you, and I'll quote from it. "The utilities' gains," in other words, advance payments, "are the consumers' losses, and businesses such as the Georgia Industrial Group and the Georgia Textile Manufacturing Association have joined consumer and environmental groups in combating the state laws and higher rates. In Florida, PCS Phosphate, which has a fertilizer plant that uses about 1% of Progress Energy's output, told the Public Service Commission that new rate increases, quote, will substantially affect, unquote, the company, quote, by directly increasing the cost of power, unquote. Ratepayer anger has resulted in the Florida Public Service Commission denying further rate increases to both of those utilities. Florida Power and Light responded by suspending further investment in its nuclear project in the Miami area. If the Progress Energy project also is abandoned, it is unclear whether ratepayers will get any of their money back. So far, almost $200 million. But the stance of the utilities is clear. According to a Progress Energy spokesperson, quote, "without this legislation, the one allowing collection of advance payments from the ratepayers, we would not be considering building new nuclear generation in Florida." A similar story is unfolding in San Antonio, Texas. The municipal utility there, CPS Energy, took a 50% stake in a two-reactor project whose cost estimate has already jumped from $5.4 billion in 2007 to $18.2 billion at the end of 2009. Such escalations were not hard to foresee. In March 2008, when the company that initiated the project, NRG, put it at $6 billion to $7 billion, Dr. Makajani of IER estimated that the cost would be $12 billion to $17.5 billion, not including cost escalations and delays. CPS share of the project is greatly in excess of the net value of its entire electrical generation, transmission, and distribution assets. In the past 3 years, CPS Energy aggressively pursued the nuclear project, on which it spent about $370 million of ratepayer money. And it also pursued renewables and also tried to complete prior generation projects. The result has been a rate increase and overcapacity. The nuclear cost increases and associated controversies have caused a scandal and the resignation of the CPS board chair. CPS Energy is now on a course to reduce its share from 50% to a little less than 8%. It's far from clear that the project will ever be completed. It has no loan guarantees as of yet. The San Antonio example illustrates that you pursue all options at your peril. Nuclear tends to marginalize efficiency and renewables, especially since it ties up so much capital for a decade without any revenue inflow. CPS is now increasing rates, and it's saddled with overcapacity even without the nuclear plant. The so-called nuclear renaissance is already fading, and we've seen this here before. After the start of the energy crisis back in October 1973, none of the reactors ordered, more than 100 in all, was completed. This is because demand was overestimated and efficiency and cost were underestimated, at great cost to ratepayers, bondholders, and industry, all which suffered needlessly higher electricity rates as a result. A similar situation is evolving right now, but more rapidly. The ratio of electricity growth per unit economic growth is now falling. Further, any serious carbon-restraining legislation that gets passed at the federal level would include stringent building efficiency standards, and buildings account for 70% of electricity demand. For instance, the Waxman-Markey bill passed by the U.S. House would require new residential and commercial buildings in 20 years to be 70% more efficient than today. So it's likely that per capita electricity growth will continue this downward trend in relation to growth overall. In this context, a long lead time, capital-intensive power plant can be ruinous. While wind turbines are capital-intensive, they can be built quickly, typically in about 2 years. And if a wind farm is half complete, you get half the electricity. If a nuclear plant is half complete, you get nothing but the bills. On to nuclear waste. Spent fuel, as we know, is being stored right now in dry cask and in spent fuel pools at Minnesota's two reactor sites. It's uncertain when or if Minnesota's nuclear waste will leave the state. Yucca Mountain has been defunded, and it might never open. Reprocessing does not solve the problem. Rather, it increases the volume of waste to be disposed of in a repository by about 6 times, even though the high-level waste volume is somewhat decreased. This counterintuitive result derives from the large increase in plutonium-contaminated waste that is generated through reprocessing operations and plutonium fuel fabrication, waste that must be disposed of in a deep geologic repository. Some point to France's nuclear program is one that the United States should emulate. We have studied the French program at IER in much detail, and we can assure you that it is not free of problems. The French are also struggling in their search for a repository. French reprocessing operations discharge about 100 million gallons of liquid radioactive waste into the English Channel every year, which, together with British reprocessing discharges, have contaminated seafood all the way up to the Arctic. 12 European countries have asked the French and British to stop this practice, but they refuse. Reprocessing also increases nuclear power's costs even above and beyond the cost of nuclear power by about 2 cents a kilowatt hour, resulting in every year $1 billion extra fuel costs each year for reprocessed fuel in France, and this is for less than 10% reduction in their uranium requirements. There is one more consideration about waste that might bear on your decision about whether or not to lift the moratorium. In the mid-1980s, before the U.S. Congress designated Yucca Mountain as the site to receive the country's commercial nuclear waste, 31 states, including Minnesota, were identified by the Department of Energy as potentially geologically suitable candidates for a second repository sites. They identified 8 sites in Minnesota. It's possible that the results of this research will be used in the future, and it's possible that of the 31 previously identified states, the federal government might consider a state that has repealed a nuclear moratorium more favorably compared to another one of those 31 sites, say Vermont, in which we heard that the state Senate last week voted decisively to shut down its only nuclear power plant in 2012. As Peter Bradford, the former NRC commissioner, points out in his testimony, which you have before you, nothing presently prevents discussion of nuclear energy in Minnesota. Indeed, if I could quote from his testimony, other states with moratoria, notably California and Wisconsin, have recently had extensive discussions of the potential role of new nuclear. He points to a California review in his testimony. And I'll go on with his testimony. Using conservative nuclear cost estimates from companies proposing to build reactors in the U.S., the California Energy Commission still found new nuclear to be far more costly than efficiency and many renewable options. The Energy Commission did not recommend repeal of the California moratorium. The function of the moratorium here in Minnesota is not to prevent debate, which is already occurring, but to protect Minnesota businesses and households from the kinds of problems that have already emerged in other places, even before a single new nuclear reactor construction and operating license has been granted. Do we want to invite the same kinds of problems as those in Florida here in Minnesota? Xcel Energy has a market cap of about the same as Progress Energy, about $9.5 billion. Indeed, the problems could be worse here in Minnesota. We stand no chance of getting federal loan guarantees at present with 26 projects ahead of us. Minnesota is already a leader in renewable energy, and we are already a leader in climate protection. Continuation on this course could create a large number of jobs, not only for the in-state energy sector, but for export. Germany is an excellent example of this potential. Germany's become a world leader in export of solar voltaic technology, even though its own potential for solar PV is not very good. Minnesota loses nothing by keeping the moratorium in place and simply waiting for at least a few years to see how the so-called nuclear renaissance plays out elsewhere. And Minnesota will gain a lot by focusing jobs on efficiency and renewables that are here today. We have these two birds in hand. Please don't trade them for one in the bush. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions of the speaker?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I don't have a question. I just wonder if we could get a written copy of your testimony.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Question. I'm sorry, I don't have your name again. I apologize.
It's Ms. Ledwig.
Ms. Audrey. Ledwidge, you made a statement about the dumping of waste into the English Channel. Can you tell me where you got that source from? I've not been able to confirm that.
Ms. Ledwidge.
Madam Chair, Senator, I got that source from a document that IEER has produced, which I would be happy to provide with you. Our materials are sourced. We mainly use primary source documents.
I'd appreciate it if you could get that to
one
us.
One thing first. I do know is that my boss has testified on a panel before the chair of Areva, the CEO of Areva, Anne LaVargeon. And he used that statement, and she took no issue with it. So I can tell you that and then also provide you with the report on which that figure is based.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Wait a minute, Senator Murphy.
Murph, that one.
I don't see you raise your hand, Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, I was going to let it. I'm not on the committee, so.
Well, you certainly can speak, though.
Thank you,
could
Madam
raise
Chair.
Your hand a little higher.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was waiting until everybody else was done. I was okay. Trying to be polite. Madam Chair, and I would like to see your documentation on your supposed facts on the 6 times the amount of radioactive material is produced in the reprocessing. So if you could make that available to the committee, I'd appreciate that. The second thing, you talked about the wind resource here in Minnesota and that we're leading in some of these technologies. And
recent data shows we're falling behind. You know, what do we do once we pass all of this legislation to keep carbon out of the air and turn off all the coal plants? Then what are we going to do for power?
Madam Chair,
Ms.
Senator.
Ledwich.
I will provide the information about
Thank
the it's actually a Department of Energy figure on the six times the amount of waste. It's part of their EIS for the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. And the question is, if not nuclear and coal, then what? The short answer, or at least the short-term answer, is that Minnesota is very well endowed with wind. We have a long way to go on efficiency. A figure that I can throw out about wind is that the entire electrical generation demand for Minnesota is dwarfed 2.5 times by the wind potential of this state. Now, obviously, we're not going to put up wind turbines every single place, but the statistic stands.
Well, Madam Chair, and there's my point. We can't even build a wind farm
Senator
in Goodhue
Murphy.
County out in the middle of a farm field. And now we've got wind resource, magnificent wind resource in southwestern Minnesota, but we can't get the power to the Twin Cities for the same reason. It's
Senator Murphy, I've got a great bill for you.
No, we're going to hear it in our committee tomorrow.
Madam Chair,
Ms.
Ledwich,
I think you understand my frustration.
I understand.
There's
some difficulty getting all those pieces together and managing the transmission and everything, but mm-hmm. we'll continue to struggle with it. Thank you, Ms. Ledwich.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll go back to our regular schedule here.
You bet.
Ben Golnick, and maybe Mike Franklin could come up to the table, too.
Hi there. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Ben Golnick, representing Sensible Energy Solutions for Minnesota. Ours is a nonprofit organization composed of a broad base of members on our advisory board. We have the president of the Minnesota Chamber. We have the heads of the Pipe Trades Union, the Building and Trades Union. We have outdoor groups, the Minnesota Outdoors Heritage Alliance, their president. We have a scientist, a nuclear physicist down in Rochester. So we have a broad-based coalition. It's really a grassroots organization. In just over 6 months, we've had hundreds of people sign up online. We've gotten a variety of anecdotes statewide. One quick one regarding wind energy, we had someone in the Iron Range contact us and tell us they just put in a whole bunch of windmills up there, and apparently one or two or several of them have already, broken down in a very short period of time. So I think that's illustrative of a lot of the frustration out there from people all around Minnesota. As I mentioned, it's a nonprofit organization, and we believe this broad-based coalition really underscores the safe, the clean, the reliable nature of nuclear energy, coupled with its indisputable job-creating potential as key reasons for repealing the moratorium on nuclear energy. Just a few months ago, we had participated in a press conference with Congressman Walz, Democrat from the 1st District, and Congressman Eric Paulson, Republican from the 3rd District. So clearly this has bipartisan support, strong grassroots support around the state. President Obama, since he gave his State of the Union address, we've seen the interest in this issue really increase exponentially in terms of traffic on our website, sign-ups. Senator Klobuchar, Governor Plenty. Recently, I've heard that Senator Franken now appears to be moving towards President Obama's position on this. So it's clear that people in Minnesota see the potential in nuclear energy and are very excited with the potential to repeal this moratorium on nuclear energy. And simply, it's an important part of the solution of addressing two things. Number one, climate change, and number two, reducing our dependence on foreign oil. So thank you.
Mr. Golnick, how many jobs do you anticipate would be created both in the construction of a new nuclear facility and then in the operation of it?
I'm not an expert on that. I know you'll have a lot of experts here today, maybe from the chamber or someone else who can speak to specific numbers. I don't know that answer.
Okay. Any questions of the speaker? Mr. Franklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Director of Energy and Elections Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber and its 2,400 members strongly support Senate File 355 as a way to ensure that ratepayers, all of our members but a few are ratepayers, can expect a balance from the Public Utilities Commission and from the utilities in their future energy planning. Further, ratepayers need to know that Minnesota has all the tools in its toolbox to meet our energy and capacity needs in 2020 and beyond. The Chamber's members, small, medium, and large businesses across Minnesota, see energy as economic development, in fact, as a jobs issue. Our state has a very important tradition of providing reliable, competitively priced electricity. We need to continue that tradition in the 21st century. Lifting the ban on new nuclear is a jobs issue not only because any new permitted plant would create direct jobs, which we were just getting at, but also, and perhaps more importantly, because lifting the ban is a signal that Minnesota wants a comprehensive energy strategy to ensure that we have reliable, competitively priced energy for the next 50 years and beyond. Some pieces of that strategy are in place. We've heard reference to the renewable energy mandate and the conservation goals. Those are parts of the strategy, and in fact, they guarantee that we won't become distracted from meeting the objectives that those statutes seek to achieve. Other parts of our puzzle, if you will, are not so well developed. As Chairman Boyd testified earlier, we have very few baseload options remaining anymore, natural gas being the most obvious, which from the customer's perspective isn't always a very good source for baseload electricity. Lifting the nuclear moratorium would not commit us to anything other than a full discussion about a specific proposed plan. You are all well aware that lifting the ban doesn't mean that we'll ever build a new plant. In fact, I've said to many of you privately that if the costs of a new plant are as excessive as some are claiming, you might find that the chamber is first in line to oppose a specific project. You are also probably aware that we have protections against cost excesses already in place elsewhere in statute. The commission has authority to reject a proposed plant, and actually the commission must reject a plant if it can't show that its power is less expensive, including environmental costs, than power generated by a renewable energy source. Indeed, this language is found in the statute that immediately precedes the moratorium. For all of these reasons, we very much appreciated the Senate's strong bipartisan show of support in 2009, and we hope that we can count on you again this year, beginning this week, with a strong vote on Senate File 355. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Mr. Franklin, you did address, you touched upon the cost factor. And the one thing that I've consistently heard from you is that you want to protect the ratepayers from excessive cost. I remember how ardent you were when we were talking about increasing wind energy in the state of Minnesota. But the cost of nuclear, from every report, is that it is more costly than other forms of baseload energy. And I'm just wondering if that doesn't cause you some concern.
Madam Chair, thank you. And just to correct the record, I don't think we testified against more wind energy. We testified against the mandate. And I do think that's important. I think it's an important distinction to make that we're, in one case, mandating a certain technology or menu of technologies. In another, we're allowing one to be discussed. Another, allowing the baseload to be, you know, in this case, nuclear, to be compared with other forms of baseload. As Chairman Boyd pointed out in his testimony, there are studies that show that nuclear is cost competitive on a levelized basis. And again, I don't know. I'm not an expert in the other than from what I read in the newspaper on what a new nuclear plant would cost in Minnesota. I'm anxious to have that discussion at the Public Utilities Commission, which does a fine job of weighing cost versus benefits. And again, if we as customers believe that that a new plant would fail that test, I believe you'd find us opposing a specific proposal. But we'd like to have that opportunity.
Okay, Madam Chair. On that point,
Senator Dahl,
because I think we heard a couple weeks ago where we were talking about transmission and some of those other issues that the chamber was there and where we had the delineation of different items on the bills, and they were concerned about the transmission costs, that the upgrades and the scrubbing of the coal-fired power plants, and the also the upgrades to the nuclear, and I think that totaled about $3 billion, and that was already creating a lot of consternation. And so I'm surprised to hear that you want something that's admittedly, at least we've heard, that it's going to cost quite a bit more than that, than $3 billion. So I'm a little surprised that we want to go down that path right now. But
Other questions or comments? Thank you. Next speaker is Carl Crimmins.
Yes, Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades. I represent the pipe fitters that build these plants. And I wanted to touch base on the jobs that the Madam Chairman brought up. According to the Nuclear Energy Institute, it takes an average of approximately 1,400 to 1,600 people to build a nuclear power plant. But more important, after the construction is completed, the plant will provide approximately 700 good-paying jobs at the plant and create and sustain another 700 jobs in the community that provides goods and services to keep the plant operational. The average nuclear plant generates approximately $430 million a year in total output for the local community and nearly $40 million per year in total labor income. In Minnesota, there are approximately 700 Minnesotans employed at Prairie Island and approximately 500 employed at Monticello. And those are good-paying jobs, and they're sustained for the life of the plant. The In 1997, the Nuclear Regulatory Committee did a study on the expense of nuclear power, and the expense of a nuclear plant was $23.33 per megawatt hour. In 2007, the cost for a nuclear power plant expense decreased to $20 per megawatt hour and stayed stable over those 10 years. By comparison, in 97, the expense of a coal-fired or fossil-fueled steam plant was $21.45 an hour, and in 10 years it rose to $30.89 an hour. So we do admit that nuclear is more expensive on the front end, but over the life of the plant, your costs go down, and as these plants' permits are extended, you're actually making the costs go down further. You're taking a 40-year plant and making it a 60-year plant, so your cost has actually gone down more. Now, there's maintenance and replacement cost over the life of that plant, but the cost of nuclear energy over the life of that plant is very low. It's one of the lowest. And there was another comment about welders. The United Association, we have 350,000 members in the United States, of which roughly half are welders, pipe fitters and welders. We spend $100 million a year on in-house training. We have welders in our employment now, members of ours that have worked on nuclear power plants. They're gearing up to go to Georgia. We don't have as many as we did in the past. There is a whole new generation coming on board. It is a very specialized installation process. It's not taken lightly. And we have continuing education all over the United States, and our welders will be up and ready to go when it comes time to do nuclear energy. Thank you, and if I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Crimmins, would you provide us with a written copy of the number of jobs that would be produced?
There's a copy in your packet.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chairman. I believe I gave some to the committee. All those facts come from the Nuclear Energy Institute or from the Nuclear Regulatory Institute. It's a one-page fact sheet. If not, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to get you that copy. Sure.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Crimmins, I'm, you know, painfully aware of the unemployment rates in the construction trades right now. It's just really a huge problem in our state, 25% unemployment. I guess the question, though, is, and I'm glad you've got some members that are going to go to Georgia to work on these plants, but even if we were to repeal this moratorium today, it seems like, or maybe I should ask Senator Koch, does anyone... I mean, what's the soonest a new plant could be built in Minnesota? What's the soonest we could see any jobs in Minnesota from this? I mean, we're years and years and years away, even if we all things went favorably because of the line that the federal government has for supporting these plants.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Crimmins.
Senator, construction could start, depending on the regulatory process with the PUC, if it's a three-year process, construction could start in 3 years. They'd start moving dirt in 3 years. You know, it would take another 4 years to 5 years to construct the plant, but it would take 3 years or whatever the regulatory process in Minnesota would entail.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess
Senator Anderson.
There's a line for federal support for loan guarantees and for other kinds of assistance so that what I've heard is it would be, you know, a decade or more before we could be in line, even if we wanted to pursue it. So I understand why you're here and why you support it, and you need jobs. I hope we can also focus on jobs that we can come up with in 2010 and 2011 and 2012 in Minnesota.
Okay. Other questions? Harry Melander.
Sure. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm the current president of the Minnesota Building Construction Trades Council, our organization. Which is affiliated with Carl, represents 40,000 construction workers throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm going to actually just kind of key real briefly on four parts of my comments. First, thank you to the committee for those opportunities that they've created in other energy-producing options that have been provided through the state, which have created employment opportunities. We thank you, and we would encourage you to do so. I want to talk about discussion, why we need to have the conversation in Minnesota, the jobs that it will create, our expectations of a clear bipartisan process, and then just kind of a closing statement. The discussion why, I think Minnesotans deserve an opportunity to talk about energy options in the state of Minnesota. You're going to hear people talk about the fears of nuclear energy, why we shouldn't do it. You're going to hear folks talk about why we should. But I think without us lifting this ban, we as Minnesotans can't have that conversation. And I think it's very important. The job issue, even though these opportunities for employment for construction workers and those that service this industry may be years out, without us having the opportunity to have a fair, real conversation here, we're limiting ourselves. I think Minnesotans are prepared to have a straightforward conversation in the options that nuclear energy can provide to not only this generation's but generations to come. A clear nonpartisan conversation, I would hope so. There's concern on both sides of that we're having this conversation for something other than what it is. I can assure you, and I've assured our friends that have been with us for years, that we won't be part of that process if that happens. We're expecting good, clear conversation and real dialogue about the benefits that nuclear energy can provide to the state of Minnesota for years to come. And the other concern about timing, and I'll do some of my tongue-in-cheek, is that life is kind of like a VCR tape, a cassette tape. At the beginning, when you rewind it, it goes very, very slow. But as you get near the end, it accelerates. That same conversation we need, or those same reasons are why we need to have and start a conversation in regards to lifting this ban. Time is against us. Limiting that conversation does nothing but put us off for years ahead. So thank you, and I'd be open up to any questions.
Questions or comments? Thank you. I'd like to call on Bill Burns and Sarah Mansell.
Madam Chair, Mark Reitzman is going to be testifying, not Sarah Mansell.
Okay.
And it might be helpful to have Bill Bigot as well.
Okay.
These are all Minnesota companies involved in the nuclear industry.
Mr. Burns.
Yes, ma'am. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and Senators. Currently, I'm the president of PAR Nuclear, LLC, a fully owned subsidiary of Westinghouse Electric Corporation. I just recently relocated to Minnesota. I've been in the business for 30 years servicing the commercial nuclear power industry. We manufacture the manipulating machines that move the nuclear fuel in and out of the reactor, and we have...
Would you speak closer to your microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. We provide that material handling equipment to the industry. I currently have a payroll in Shoreview, Minnesota of about 208 employees. In 5 years, I expect that to be 275. I'm supplying cranes and equipment to China, Korea, Georgia, but not to Minnesota. After 30 years in this business, the first 10 years, I participated in plant shutdowns that went from 120 days to $70 million to today's environment. They were less than 20 days and less than $20 million. This has become an economic economically viable operation. I apologize for my nervousness. It's my first attendance to a legislative session. So, myself and my two brothers have been in this business for 30 years. This is a viable alternative. You need to open the debate. It is the debate. It is not about a decision. But I came to Minnesota because of independent thinking. And I have to register to vote here in a month. We just opened an $8 million facility in Hutchinson, Minnesota, to build the major cranes for nuclear power plants. We're building 6 units in the U.S. and 1 in China. The next 6 years, we should put on about 20 employees in Hutchinson. We need welders as well. I have a lot of hiring to do. I'd appreciate some motivation to do that hiring. So mine was more of being a proponent. I don't have any other anecdotes. I certainly.
It's fine.
But
any questions of the speaker? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Berners, can you use those cranes for anything other than that specific purpose with the nuclear power plants?
No, sir. They are a specific application. They're a major crane in the top of the dome, if you will, in a nuclear reactor.
Thank you.
What brought you to Minnesota?
Hard workers and independent thinking. I'm hoping to influence that here today, that independent thinking is going to be just that. But you need to put this option on the table. I'm here as a proponent of that. And after 30 years, I can tell you, nuclear is not an incendiary word. It's used for fear. I take exception to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burns. Next speaker is Mark Reitzman. Is that correct?
That's right.
Perhaps you could spell your name for us.
Like the Wright brothers, with a few extra letters at the end, S-M-A-N, Reitzman.
Mr. Reitzman.
Madam Chair and committee members, I appreciate the chance to testify. I also have been in the nuclear field more than 30 years, received a nuclear engineering degree back in 1980. Being a native Minnesotan, I'm back here after 12 moves. I spent a number of years working with GE, started in their nuclear business. I went overseas, and I was part of the power gen business, part of that because nuclear for 20 years or so really was nascent. But participating in power gen overseas, I saw the number of new units consuming natural gas being put in place in China and other areas that are developing rapidly. It gives one a perspective when I think back that we could have been producing twice as much nuclear power in this country if we had not shut down 100 plants that were under construction. So my nuclear background says that there may be projections of fuel costs that may change over time. We now see the incredible efficiency of nuclear power with the low fuel cost. Yes, there's a high startup cost. My current position, and has been for 10 years, is CEO of PAR Systems, which is a Minnesota-based company. Around the country, we have about 350 employees. Almost half of them are in Minnesota. I'm here to testify in favor of nuclear and lifting the moratorium, but I will tell you we do automation for nuclear. We also can do automation for other energy sources as solar is produced, et cetera. So we are not biased in one way or another, but with the nuclear perspective that I bring, I will just tell you that nuclear has been proven to be very safe, very clean, and environmentally friendly. You didn't hear those words 30 years ago when I graduated as a nuclear engineer in the same context. Many, many, many people have now recognized that that really is indeed the case. I would also tell you that energy and use of nuclear is extremely strategic. Many other countries have figured that out. And I think Minnesota needs this option. In the way we approach our business in automation, the way we approached our business when I used to run GE's global nuclear service business before I left that company, proactive, thoughtful, planned maintenance is always important.
and lifting the Minnesota ban on new plant construction supports a meaningful approach to a constructive dialogue about the potential for the next generation of nuclear plant construction in Minnesota. Nuclear does mean highly skilled, highly paid jobs. You've heard a lot about that already. And our company has a large number of very skilled engineers and technicians who build high-tech robotics and material handling and inspection systems, which continue to make the entire nuclear cycle safe. And we work with partners such as Westinghouse Bar Nuclear to do that. And for these reasons and many more, I strongly support the lifting of the moratorium on new plant construction in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Reitzman. Senator Koch, your time is up at this point. I'd be willing to give you five more minutes, but I'm wondering how you want to assign those 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, Bill, is it all right if we... Okay. Well, then, Madam Chair, I'd like to call up, if we could, Rolf Westgaard and Scott Melby. Scott Melby is the uranium. Hopefully, I could help address that question. And then Rolf Westgaard as well. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ms. Kessler, I think you have my handouts. Are you going to get those to each of the senators?
They've already been handed out.
I don't think so. Ah, you have it.
She's looking pretty good.
who will start here?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to address this hearing. I'm Scott Melby. I'm president of Cameco, Inc. We're a nuclear energy company located in Eden Prairie. Our 12 employees here in the Twin Cities are responsible for the global marketing activities of the world's largest uranium supplier. Our main production centers are located in Wyoming, Nebraska, Saskatchewan, Canada, and Kazakhstan. We presently are the largest supplier of uranium fuel to the U.S. electric utility industry. And as a prominent supplier to the industry, we have the unique opportunity to witness firsthand the exciting growth of nuclear power that is underway around the world. Whether it's in Georgia, Texas, the Carolinas, China, India, Japan, Korea, Finland, or France, the benefits of safe, clean, reliable, and economic baseload nuclear power are being recognized as having a central role in these states' and countries' future energy mix. For Minnesota to be facing our own tough energy choices in the coming years without the benefit of having all the alternatives on the table is short-sighted and dangerous to our energy security and economic prosperity. I would urge the Minnesota legislature to repeal the moratorium and allow for a healthy debate to take place among all the energy alternatives available today. Nuclear power is not the only answer to meet Minnesota's energy needs. But I would assert that nuclear power has and should continue to occupy a key role in the supply portfolio and will evaluate very favorably among available alternatives. Namely, it provides reliable baseload power. Nuclear plants today target capacity factors in excess of 90% through all scenarios of volatile demand and changing weather conditions. This base of 24/7 power is an excellent complement to our significant installed yet intermittent wind capacity in Minnesota. It's economic supply. The upfront capital investment, as we've discussed at length today, can be significant. But the operating cost of nuclear compares very favorably to that of wind, solar, coal, or natural gas. And here, the stability of fuel costs is a major advantage. And finally, it's clean air energy. The absence of CO2, NOx and mercury emissions from nuclear power provide substantial clean air benefits on the environmental front. This aspect has even turned former anti-nuke activists into believers. So to summarize, my nuclear fuel company in Eden Prairie is fortunate to be thriving and hiring through an economic downturn, as much of the world is either embarking on new nuclear energy for the first time or expanding their existing successful programs. So why should industrial and residential consumers in Minnesota be denied this leading energy source when evaluating alternatives for our future electricity needs? Thank you, and I'll welcome any questions that you may have.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of quick questions, Mr. Melby. You must have some projections as far as supply of uranium worldwide. Is that, you know, can you give me a number of years that we could expect that that would be around?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. One of the great advantages of nuclear energy is the uranium fuel cycle. Uranium is one of the most abundant elements in the Earth's crust, and for mining companies, the challenge is just finding that in economic concentrations that would warrant new mine development. In the near term, we have abundant supplies of uranium in the United States. In the state of Wyoming alone, there are three applications for new in-situ recovery mining uranium operations before the NRC. Our facility in Wyoming is also looking to double production in the coming years. So we have enormous potential in the United States to grow. We led the world in uranium production in the 80s. And certainly can contribute more. Another major supplier is Canada, and particularly Saskatchewan. Canada is really the what the Arabian Peninsula is to oil. Saskatchewan, Canada is that to uranium. And our company alone has $500 million of reserves that are either under development or can be developed in the coming years. The third major country supplying the United States is Australia, another reliable ally who are expanding their uranium industry. BHP Billiton, one of the largest mining companies in the world, is expanding, doubling, tripling, maybe quadrupling production from the copper, gold, and uranium operations at Olympic Dam. To go on, we have other non-conventional sources of uranium that can be made available.
Is that sufficient?
I was just curious, Madam Chair, is that a 100-year supply or a 200-year supply? Or?
No. Mr. Malpe.
The IAEA, which is a UN organization in Vienna, regularly tracks the worldwide global resources of uranium at various cost categories. I may need to get you the exact figures before Thursday of their current projections. But I think in the 100-year supply is
thank you.
Is reasonable, and with price signals, there's no reason, like any other energy commodity, that additional resources can't be developed.
Another option is thorium.
Excuse me, sir. Just wait to be called on.
Okay. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Melby. Are there any further questions? Okay. Mr. Westgaard?
Yes, I'm Rolf Westgaard. I teach classes on energy for the University of Minnesota's College of Continuing Education. I'm here to answer the technical questions that weren't answered before, especially the ones by Senator Anderson. But I will add on the one we were just discussing. Another option is thorium. Thorium is several times more prevalent in the Earth's crust than uranium. Thorium itself is not directly fissionable, but you can convert thorium to uranium-233, which is like uranium-235, and is a fissionable fuel. We'll probably in the next several years see thorium reactors appearing, and that'll greatly extend the life of our fuel supplies over and above what chemical can provide. There are also other options that we don't really have time to go into. I just also want to hit the first question from Senator Anderson about the tritium issue, which has come up, and the refusal to renew the reactor in Vermont. Tritium is produced by reactors, but it's mainly produced by pressurized water reactors because in the primary water supply that cools the reactor, certain chemicals are introduced for a number of reasons that we don't have time to go into. One of those is boric acid. The boron in that reactor gets converted to lithium, helium, and tritium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, and some of that can and does leak out from the reactor. Up to now, not enough has leaked out from any reactor to meet federal guidelines or to cause a problem. That's especially true in the one in Vermont because that's not a pressurized water reactor. That's a boiling water reactor, and they don't leak much tritium at all, so it's rather ironic that that one's being canceled for the publicity around that reason. Anyhow, I'm responsible for this handout, which you have, the first page of which has a list of the advanced thermal reactors, the so-called third-generation reactors that are currently being offered on the market and being built around the world. The most popular of those is the Westinghouse AP reactor series, the 1000. The 1000 is the one that the loan guarantees have been guaranteed for in Vogtle, Georgia. It's also the one that's been licensed to China, and a number of them are being produced and built in China. The larger version is the AP or APR 1400. South Korea has licensed that, and they're marketing that one around the world, especially in the Middle East. We have some numbers for that one because South Korea is offering a fixed price installation of the APR 1400. They've sold in number, as I say, in the Middle East. There are $5 billion each. If you throw in the site preparation and interest on deposits and so on, you come to about $6 billion. In Korea, those are being built at around $3.5 to $4 billion, but they have to charge more when they install them in another country, and maybe there's a markup there or whatever. That reactor will generate about 12 billion kilowatt hours in a year. That $20 a megawatt hour price is a good one. It costs about 2 cents a kilowatt hour for everything to run a nuclear power reactor. The total cost, that, as I say, that unit at wholesale at 12 billion kilowatt hours will generate about $480 million in revenue at wholesale. The cost to produce that that amount of electricity in the reactor is about half that, about $240 million a year. That leaves another $240 million for depreciation, profit, and whatever, and provides ample security for any loans that are put forth in order to build those reactors. The third-generation reactors that are being installed, and you have the whole list here pretty much around the world, are evolutionary upgrades to the current fleet, which are considered second-generation reactors, 104 of them in the U.S., another few hundred elsewhere in the world. They all operate safely, conveniently, and economically. In January's bills, Xcel Energy included an insert. They described their fuel supplies in terms of cost and reliability. In that list of fuel sources, the cheapest, lowest cost energy source for Xcel Energy was nuclear, beat everything else. The most reliable also listed was nuclear. There are several other pages which I'll just skim through in
Mr.
the...
Mr. Westgaard, yes. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up because okay. The time is up.
I was asked to write editorials by two of Minnesota's newspapers about nuclear energy. Those are listed here. The most interesting one here, though, is from the state of Texas. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, runs the Texas grid system. Texas has the most wind by far of any state. It's 8,000 megawatts of nameplate capacity in 2009, ran at 8.7% effective operating time, and it produced 1% of Texas electric energy. It produced about 700 megawatts out of the 8,000 rated. They forecast for 5 years. They're still holding wind energy for Texas at about 1%. It's a substitute, not a supplement, for baseload power.
Thank you. Are there questions of the speaker? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Senator Carlson.
It's not really a question. I just want to say that every time I talk to Mr. Westgaard, I learn a lot. I don't know if you remember, but I'm a friend of Rich's. But you, last time we talked, you had the same effect on me, and I really appreciate the depth of your knowledge and the clarity of your information.
Thank you. The last editorial is about T. Boone Pickens, who announced a grand plan to cover the Midwest.
Mr. Westgaard,
with wind
we have
turbines.
To finish. I'm okay. Sorry. We'll look
Please
at your it. We'll look at your handout.
Thank you.
I'd like to call on Steve Morris now.
Madam Chair, if I may, while Steve is coming up here, I would just point out that our last potential testifier, Tim Cavanaugh, from General Manager for Federated Co-ops, has a statement in your packet.
Yes, that is in our packet. I would thank you for pointing that out. I was going to do the same.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps I can get started while we're booting up the visual. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today, and I appreciate the committee is running a little late, and I appreciate you staying to listen to this testimony. My name is Steve Morris. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We are the largest environmental conservation coalition in the state, comprised of more than 80 organizational members representing more than 450,000 members of Minnesotans within their combined membership. I had the pleasure of serving in the legislature in the state Senate from 87 through 99, and so was here when this was discussed in great detail the last time in 1994, and I'll refer to that back to that just a little bit in a little bit later. What I'd like to do first, though, however, is talk about some of our poll results. As you may know, as part of our collaborative agenda work, we do annual polling, scientifically based polling of the citizens in Minnesota. We do that in order to track attitudes, how things are changing, to help our members in their communications and how we discuss things with the public. We usually keep these for internal purposes, but quite frankly, we find the information on this issue so compelling that I would like to present it here to the committee today. As maybe some of you heard, on Minnesota Public Radio yesterday, there was something about, well, there's no scientific polling that's been conducted recently, and I counted four times at least that I've heard proponents today talk about how this is a bipartisan issue and there's broad public support. Well, I'd like to suggest that we should actually look at the scientific polling that's been done. And I think we can go to the first slide. First, I'd just like to tell you about the methodology, just a little bit of the polling. We interviewed 605 Minnesotans the week before Thanksgiving. It was done by a team of two companies of nationally known polling firms. One would be a Fairbanks, Maslin, Mullen, and Metz, and they're a democratically aligned polling firm with offices in several locations across the country, work with the Berkeley office, as well as Public Opinion Strategies, which is a nationally known Republican firm based in Colorado. And we work with them because to get the bipartisan, neutral political view, if you will, but also they do a lot of conservation work. We worked with them extensively in the Vote Yes campaign in 1998. Let's move on. Excuse me, 2008. 2008. We've been talking the 90s too much here. Yeah, let's move on to the next one. Let me start by a straight question, straight out of the chute. We asked people, you know, what would you like to see increase in terms of power generation here in Minnesota? And basically, the results break into three tiers. The first tier being wind and solar. People love this stuff. 92% of Minnesotans think we ought to be doing more wind and solar. The next tier is hydroelectric natural gas. And the numbers are pretty good. 70-80% think that we ought to look at expanding those options. However, you'll see when we get to nuclear and coal, the numbers drop off pretty precipitously. They are at the third tier. It's still a bit of a push. It's 52% of Minnesotans said, yes, we think we should do more nuclear power. What's interesting here is that this is straight out of the chute without any background about Minnesota policy. What we interpret this is basically that, well, we should kind of discuss all options sort of reaction. And I'll remind people that the MCAG report that the governor's Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group recommended that, you know, first we ought to be doing wind and solar before we'd be looking at things such as nuclear. But the message here is basically stay the course. We can flip to the next one. Now, what we did, though, is we actually went in a little deeper and said, well, let's talk about Minnesota. And a lot of the polling that you hear is that first question right out of the chute. Gee, should we do more nuclear? Well, when we told people, the question is here, when we told people, you know, we currently have a moratorium in Minnesota, do you think that we should repeal that moratorium or stay the course? And the numbers flip. And you'll see that 52% of Minnesotans think we ought to maintain the course. We ought to keep the moratorium in place. And what's interesting is the intensity. And when we think about public policy, we kind of have a threshold of 40%. When you have 40% of any poll indicating that people feel strongly about something, you really have an actionable issue, if you will, in terms of the public. And what you'll see is 41% say absolutely we should be keeping the moratorium, whereas the intensity on allowing new plants is quite a bit less, and there's a 13-point spread there. So what we did is we then said, well, let's look at the demographics on this issue a little bit. Who are these people? Is this a bipartisan issue? Is it, you know, who are these people? So this is the demographics on it. It's not a bipartisan issue with the public. Now, my congressman is Representative Tim Walz, and I'm greatly disappointed in the fact that he's decided he wants to leave Washington and come back here and work on state policy, because I think he's out of his realm, and he's certainly out of touch with his constituents. You see, Democrats overwhelmingly think that we should keep the current policy we have. We should stay the course. There's a reason we put this policy in place, and we should keep it. Independents feel the same way. Republicans, it's a little different. It's not a bipartisan issue with the public. There are people on both sides of the issue who supported it, but it's not a bipartisan issue with the public. And if you look at the strong Republicans and strong Democrats, the differences get more sharp. Then we get to gender. And Senator Anderson, you'll remember this from some of the past discussions that we had from this 16 years ago. There is a tremendous gender gap on this issue. Women, overwhelmingly, do not think that we should be repealing this moratorium. In fact, it's fairly tight with men, but with women, it's quite decisive. And then we broke it down by party and age. And the other thing that's interesting is on Democrats and Republicans, there's not much of an age difference. But on independents, overwhelmingly, I wouldn't say overwhelmingly, but a pretty decisive number of the 18 to 49-year-olds say that we should stick the course that we have now. We should keep the moratorium in place and leave well enough alone. And the last thing, slide I'd like to show you in the demographics has to do with party by gender. The number on women were very strong, but what's amazing is if you look on the Democratic side, you know, many more women than not. It's about it's more than a 5-to-1 ratio, Democratic women in support of maintaining the moratorium. Republican women actually support maintaining the moratorium. It's Republican men that by a 2-to-1 margin want to repeal it. And independents, you'll notice the gender split there very decisively. Women by more than 3-to-1 margin support the moratorium the way it is and would not like to see it repealed. So it really isn't a public issue that is supported by the people here in Minnesota. It's certainly not supported bipartisanly by the people in Minnesota, and it's clearly not supported by gender. And then we looked at people, asked people, and said, well, you know, what if a nuclear plant were to be built? And what we found is that voters were very uncomfortable with many of the potential consequences of nuclear power. If you ask them, well, would you like to have one near your home? 56% said no. Again, 48%, a fairly high intensity level. But as we went further down the arguments, what about if we store all the waste from a new nuclear plant here in our state, which is a pretty likely outcome, seeing we've been pretty ineffective in finding any place to ship our waste and the prospects are just getting dimmer. Fully 59% of the public say, no, that's not a good idea. 50% intensely. What about if we slow down and this becomes a distraction for our commitment to wind and solar and other renewables that are currently filling the gaps that we have? 72% of Minnesotans, 61%, another 10% jump up in intensity, say they strongly are opposed to a plant that would do that. And then the prospect that Ms. Ledwidge raised, that what happens if we have to go back to the drawing board and look for a new waste depository someplace in the country? What happens if we become a depository in our deposits up in northern Minnesota? Fully 87% of the state say, no, we don't want that. 3/4 very, very intensely. So then we asked one more series of questions, and that was overwhelmingly, you know, what are the issues that people feel need to be addressed as it comes to nuclear power? And there are 4 questions here, and all of them kind of break the threshold on intensity, all of them more than 40%. And we feel, the public feels, that before we really think about nuclear power, we should make sure that all the costs of power plant construction be paid by power companies and not passed on to taxpayers. We had a fair amount of discussion about that today. And there have been ways that it's been passed on to ratepayers ahead of time before there's power in other states. People don't want to see that happen. People would like to see that there be a permanent storage site for radioactive nuclear waste available Not a pipe dream, not a projection, not a commission with an uncertain timeline and uncertain outcomes, but there actually be a repository available by some pretty strong numbers, 3/4 of Minnesotans. Requiring that current renewable energy and conservation projects be implemented before nuclear plants are built, again, about the same number, 77%, more than 50% feel that with some intensity. And then lastly, requiring clear evidence that we'll actually get clearer rates. People are a little softer on that, but about 71%. In summary, again, let me just reiterate that it's a myth that this has broad bipartisan public support. In fact, what we see in the polling and what we know in the experiences in the past is that this is a deeply divisive issue. People feel strongly on each side of the issue. But what we also know from the polling is that repeal of the moratorium is decisively opposed by women, people under 50, and Democrats. So I don't know. That doesn't seem like a broad bipartisan coalition on my part. That's all we're going to share today in the polling, but if members would be interested, we'd be happy to connect you with the pollsters that conducted the polling, and you could have further discussions. But I wanted to share with you the polling that we did have. The second point.
Mr. Morris, yes. Could you provide us with a copy of your slides?
We could. As a matter of fact, they're on your computer.
Okay.
I don't know whose computer this is, but.
Okay.
If we don't erase them, they're yours.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The second point that I want to make goes back to the 1994 legislative process, and I'd like to just hand out a little summary sheet here if I could. There's a page I could hand them out. As I mentioned earlier, I was a member of the Senate Environment Committee in 1994, and I think there's only one person on this committee who was there then, and that's Senator Anderson. It was her first term, and Senator Murphy, who wasn't on the committee, but also his first term. And the discussion that I'm hearing today really reminds me a little bit of that movie Caddyshack, where we have to continue to kind of whack the mole, if you will. And one of the things that happens and that you are all familiar with is, that's being handed out, there was a group of 10 of us, bipartisan at the time, on the committee that stopped the moratorium bill and stopped the storage bill and then worked up some conditions that were ultimately attached to the bill. Because, quite frankly, we did not believe that the storage would be temporary or it would be as cheap as we were being promised at the time. One condition that ultimately became law was this moratorium that says that we will not go forward and do new plants until we've taken care of some of the issues that we just talked about here and that were on the table at that time. Now, one of the things that happened in 1994 is that in addition to the piece of legislation that Senator Koch has before you, is that we also passed some findings into law. And those of you working the process know, at least at that time, findings were really quite unusual because we had this guy by the name of Senator Miriam who would always strike all those because they don't have the force and effect of law. But what they do is they document some of the thinking at the time. And what I just handed out were the findings that are currently in law, and I just want to read a couple of sentences from there. The legislature finds that there is great uncertainty over the means and costs of disposing of radioactive wastes. Ratepayers are at risk for those uncertain and potentially enormous costs. While these potential costs do not currently warrant closing an operating nuclear power plant, they do warrant a moratorium on new nuclear power plant construction. Unfortunately, those issues that were raised so clearly 16 years ago have not been resolved in any way. As a matter of fact, what we have to remind ourselves is that if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. And we've been down this path before. In 1991, NSP came and said, we need a place to temporarily store our waste. We need it to be temporary because Yucca Mountain is in the works. I'm sure you remember some of that, or you've been told some of that history. You've heard some of that history. In 1992, an ALJ judge, Alan Klein, said, you know, these things are designed for 25 years. They may last 100 years. We may have to call this longer term, and it had to go to the legislature. NSP at the time, as we heard today, said, you know, Yucca Mountain is going to be taking waste by 98, but realistically that probably won't happen. But we think something more likely is 2010, which is a more realistic time frame. But they did acknowledge that at that time that was maybe a bit optimistic. And now, as we know today, Yucca Mountain is, to quote Secretary Chu, is off the table. It's not something that is being discussed any further. After up to $13 billion in expenditure and another $20 billion of our money put in the bank, we don't even have a plan B. What we've been doing is chasing a goal that's an elusive goal and getting further and further away and not getting any better. So I would just suggest that those very issues that were passed into law 16 years ago still hold true, and you've heard some of them from Lisa Ledwidge earlier today also. My last point that I want to make is a little bit about our policy work at Minnesota Environmental Partnership. As a collaboration, every year we run through a process. We have our members nominate issues. They get together, sort them out, what's most important. We have hearings on them internally, and then we actually vote on those issues. This is one of the issues that came into play this year. And I want to hand out two other pieces of paper if I could, then I'm done handing out paper. One of them is a fact sheet on our that includes our position on nuclear power moratorium. And while that is being handed out, what I'd like to do is just briefly summarize our position on it. We've had a lot of excellent testimony today, and we appreciate you taking the time. But the bottom line is, to quote from our fact sheet, and it's on the back of the fact sheet in the middle of that paragraph, it says, more nuclear energy is not a sensible or cost-effective solution for increasing our energy independence. I think we're all very concerned about our energy independence, but it's not something that we need to repeal, to act on this legislation now to gain that. Until solutions are found to the answers, to answer the concerns about new nuclear power plants, Minnesota should focus its efforts on increasing energy efficiency, developing more clean, renewable energy sources. We also have a letter that was signed by, and I didn't count the number of groups, many of our member groups, but there must be 43 groups. And basically, it directs a little bit more detail of some of the concerns, but basically the messages with more supporting documentation is to stay on the energy course that we as a state have mapped out, which is to increase the jobs, increase renewable energy, that we have very serious concerns about the cost of new nuclear power plants, and that we have very serious concerns that continue to be unanswered, and only the questions and the holes only get worse about how we're going to manage the waste. So I would appreciate if at the appropriate time that you have a chance to review that, that you review that. In summary, we do not see a compelling reason to move forward with this legislation at this time. We're very concerned that it's a bit of a herd mentality, if you will. It came out as kind of a surprise last year. I heard Senator Dill's comments about him being surprised that it passed the Senate last year. In fact, we believe it's a distraction for an eventuality that may be 34 years out, as we heard today. There's no urgency to act on this legislation today. It is not needed to have thoughtful discussion about the future of nuclear power in the state. In fact, that's exactly what you've been doing here today. That's exactly what's already occurred in the House. And it's good to have that discussion. We think there are serious issues that need to be discussed and addressed, and we should move forward and address those. Our suggestion is that you leave sleeping dogs lie. There are serious issues about the nuclear energy industry, but we do not need to move forward with this legislation today at this time. And thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Just kind of going along with the comments that you made about how temporary storage of nuclear energy, I had our staff do some research, and they came up with some information that in 1985, the Department of Energy identified 8 possible sites in Minnesota for a second repository. And second national repository. Those were in the northwest, central, and south central parts of our state. They fell near the communities of East Grand Forks, Carlstead, Thief River Falls, Bemidji, Park Rapids, Detroit Lakes, Moorhead, Morris, Glenwood, St. Cloud, Princeton, Becker, and New Ulm. So, and then I was struck by Ms. Ledwidge's comments that if we were to remove the moratorium, that we may become a site for potential repository.
Well,
comments, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Morris, where did that survey originate, and who did you send the survey out to? This one on.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the survey originated with the opinion polling firms. It's 605 voters, randomly selected voters across the state. We could get you all the demographic information about it.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, just two more follow-ups, if you don't mind. Mr. Morris, when was the last time you visited a nuclear power plant in the state?
Mr. Morris?
Oh, you know, they don't let just any environmental advocate in those plants. But I did visit such a plant, and I visited the Prairie Island plant. I imagine it was maybe 93, 94. I've also been to Yucca Mountain in subsequent years in the mid-90s as the early tunneling work was going on. And so I have done some due diligence on the issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Morris, I do believe that if you did ask Xcel, they probably would give you a tour of any one of their plants there at Monticello or Prairie Island. And I also would just like to say that I, too, am represented by Congressman Waltz, and I do believe that he is representing his constituents. That is certainly not a herd mentality. He is listening to this very issue, so I would just like to state that.
Other comments or questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, just to respond to your comment earlier, I don't know if people have seen this report that was done by a number of our groups that was released yesterday, Keeping Minnesota's Nuclear Moratorium to Protect Ratepayers and the Environment. But in this report, we actually have the maps of the various locations that were looked at earlier by the federal government. And we do think it's not a far-fetched concern to understand that we are going to have some new sites, and if we are generating more waste, I don't know why we wouldn't be back on the list.
Maybe you could leave us a copy of
that,
if that's possible. Senator Cook, did you have a comment?
Well, no, Madam Chair. I was just going to point out that there's, you know, 40 other states that do not have a moratorium either, so there's ample selection.
Senator Sanjan.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Senator Morris. Once a senator, always a senator, right?
That's what they tell me. This title sticks.
I sit here kind of a little perplexed. I'm just going to ask the question. If it's all about this nuclear thing and nuclear. Sometimes I wonder how to pronounce it. But if we were out in Virginia building aircraft carriers or wherever they build nuclear submarines, or as a matter of fact, I suspect if a nuclear submarine came up the Mississippi River to St. Paul, we'd probably all go out and look at it, and we wouldn't be terribly fearful. If we went over to St. Joe's down here or regions over here and needed some diagnostic work, and that involved nuclear medicine, and we had an isotope injected into ourselves, we probably wouldn't be all that concerned about it. But when we start talking about nuclear power, it's just like the lights come on, if you will, and that's not the right way to say it, but it just engenders so much emotions. And yet, when they build aircraft carriers, I think it's in Virginia, Newport News, or wherever it is, I don't hear about any great revolutions out there with respect to they're doing one of these things. It's nuclear powered, it's dangerous, it's awful, or anything of the like. Do you have any... It's not a very good question, but I'm just trying to get at the perception of this form of energy and why in one form it's so dangerous and terrible and why in another form it's so useful.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Morris.
Senator Sanjan, I'm not an expert at all of those details, but let me just say a couple of things because you asked me. Number one, there's a big difference between the high-level radioactive waste that comes out of a reactor and the low-level radioactive waste that comes out of our medical industry. We have a separate regulatory regime for handling those low-level radioactive wastes. And although some people have some concerns of them about those, there's not the level of contamination or the length of its duration is not as long, and there's a different regime for handling them. I think it's a very different thing when we're dealing with nuclear power, and there is an emotional reaction. There's no doubt about that, but, you know, I don't think we've talked a lot about that today. You know, what we've talked about is what happens to the waste. What we were promised 16 years ago has gone up, poof, and we don't have an answer to it. There's not an easy answer to it, and we've talked about the costs. and that is anything but emotional. That's a very straightforward thing that we need to look at first. And if anything, quite frankly, I think the emotional side is on the other side, because it's that first slide I put up where you say, well, you know, gee, should everything be on the table? And everyone kind of says, well, that kind of makes sense, as if nuclear power is off the table for some law that we have on our books. And that's not what's keeping plants from going forward. And so I think there are strong, as I said at the end of the polling, there are strong, intense feelings on both sides of this. And I think the way to really get around it is to have reasoned, rational discussion. And I don't think this legislation furthers that, except when you're doing it in committee. But I don't think that rushing to a repeal is a way to really move the discussion forward, because I think we do need a more educated and thoughtful discussion about it. And I just think it should take longer. There's no urgency about this right now. And we should answer some of these questions before we move forward.
Thank you, Senator Morris. And members, I appreciate your patience. We have three more speakers, and I would appreciate your being able to hear them. So we will move as quickly as possible. Next speaker is Victoria Winfrey. Ms. Winfrey.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon, or I should say good evening. My name is Vicki Winfrey, and I'm president of the Prairie Island Tribal Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My community has been living in the shadow of the Prairie Island nuclear plant for nearly four decades. We are among the closest communities in the nation to a nuclear power plant and its above-ground nuclear waste storage site. The plant's two reactors and 26 nuclear waste storage casks sit just 600 yards from our homes. No other community in Minnesota should have to live in fear of nuclear power and nuclear waste the way our community does, until a permanent national solution for dealing with nuclear waste is found. We oppose lifting Minnesota's moratorium on construction of new power plants or new reactors at existing plants. For 37 years, Prairie Island Nuclear Plant has been a major safety, health, and environmental concern to our community. Prairie Island is one of the oldest operating nuclear plants in the nation. It has suffered two radiological leaks, as well as tritium leaks and contamination. Approximately 650 tons of high-level radioactive nuclear waste is stored in the plant's 26 dry casks, which sit on a cement pad in the floodplain of the Mississippi River. The plant's high-voltage power lines run directly adjacent to many homes in our community. Hazardous materials and equipment are transported to and from the plant and near or through our community on a regular basis. Whether related to improperly transporting radioactive equipment, the loss of radioactive tools, or findings of declining human performance at the plant by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, numerous operating errors are extremely frightening to the citizens of the Prairie Island community. If the plant is relicensed for an additional 20 years, as Xcel has proposed, 69 new casks would be necessary, bringing the total number of casks at Prairie Island to 98. That is nearly 2,500 tons of nuclear waste that would likely be stored at Prairie Island for generations. 28 years after Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and mandated the establishment of a nuclear waste repository, the future of the nation's nuclear waste disposal program remains very much in doubt. The proposed spent fuel repository at Nevada's Yucca Mountain has suffered numerous political and bureaucratic setbacks, and most recently been abandoned by the Obama administration. It has become painfully clear that the Yucca Mountain will likely never reopen, Our community and other communities in Minnesota and across America have been left with a horrible realization about so-called temporary nuclear waste storage near our homes. Whether nuclear waste is stored today is where it will be stored in the future, and where nuclear waste is generated in the future is where it will stay for generations. Before Minnesota and the nation embrace a nuclear power resurgence, the Prairie Island Indian community believes the federal government should follow the law and deliver on its promise to move nuclear waste to a safe and secure facility. Until that happens, it is irresponsible to entertain building new nuclear power plants or new reactors at existing plants. And that's it for me today. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions of the speaker? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next speaker is Kay Coleman. You can put the top of that laptop down.
Good evening, Senator Solon and members of the committee. My name is Kay Kuhlman. I'm the City Council Administrator for the City of Red Wing. And with me at the table to my right is Marshall Halleck, who is also in City Administration for the City of Red Wing. And to my left is Jeff O'Neill, the City Administrator for Monticello. Red Wing and Monticello have benefited greatly from having the state's two nuclear power plants in our communities. They provide good, high-paying jobs for many of our citizens and are a significant component of our property tax base. Minnesota also has benefited greatly by our community's willingness to host these facilities. These power plants produce power cheaply and reliably and have made Minnesota a more competitive place to do business. That said, facts cannot be denied. In Minnesota, and in particular in our cities and adjacent to the Prairie Island Indian community, nuclear waste is accumulating with no place to go. Right now, there are 26 dry casts in Red Wing and 11 dry casts in Monticello. Each of these casts stores approximately 25 tons of nuclear waste. That makes for 925 tons of nuclear waste on the banks of the Mississippi River in Minnesota. After these plants decommission, there will be 98 casks in Red Wing and 65 casks in Monticello. If the federal government continues its legacy of inaction, there will be approximately 4,000 tons of nuclear waste in our communities with nowhere to go. Compounding this problem is that after the plants decommission, Xcel Energy will all but stop paying property taxes, which is our critical source for providing city services to these facilities. Red Wing and Monticello are deeply concerned that the legacy of federal inaction will just continue to repeat itself. Originally, we were told, don't worry about it, we're going to reprocess. Then we were told, don't worry about it, we're going to permanently dispose of it in a deep geological repository. Now, 17 presidential blue ribbon commissions later, we are back at square one. If Plan A was Yucca Mountain and Yucca Mountain is now off the table, we hope that Plan B won't become de facto repository sites in Minnesota. You have heard that dry cast storage is safe and that Red Wing, Monticello, and Minnesota have nothing to worry about should the federal government not pick up the waste for several decades. Our response to this is twofold. First, dry cast storage has been deemed safe over the short term by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. However, over the long term, stranding spent nuclear fuel in tasks intended for short-term storage poses an unacceptable level of risk for our communities and to all Minnesotans. Secondly, after our tax bases shrink upon decommissioning, our ability to provide an adequate availability of critical fire and emergency services to these facilities will be significantly stressed. Also, one last point on this issue. Just because the direct cost for dry cast storage will be covered by Xcel Energy or its successor, this does not mean there will be no cost to the city. The most fundamental charge of our cities is to provide police, fire, and emergency response capability based on the risks within our community. the dry cask storage facilities will be a large and significantly underfunded risk within our communities. This says nothing about the impact on land use and development. Simply put, nobody is going to develop land around a dry cask facility. With that said, Red Wing and Monticello would support lifting the nuclear power moratorium, provided the legislature does the following. Direct the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to estimate and fund long-term storage costs in the decommissioning fund. Long-term must mean more than the current calculations, which ignore the status of Yucca Mountain. The Minnesota PUC should also estimate and fund host community costs in its long-term calculations. Senator Sharon has legislation that will be introduced this Thursday to do exactly this. We urge the Senate to pass this important bill. If the Minnesota PUC is not able to fulfill this directive, create a new state commission to address long-term storage issues. Dealing with the impact of storing waste on-site for the long-term will require the input of many state agencies. Red Wing and Monticello have proposed creating a Minnesota Nuclear Waste Commission made up from members of the Pollution Control Agency, Office of Energy Security, Health Department, and others to look at the long-term storage issues and planning. Red Wing and Monticello also request that the Minnesota legislature push back on the federal government's lack of action. Minnesota has leverage to push the federal government, escrowing the nuclear waste fee paid by Minnesota ratepayers, directing long-term storage estimates and funding, and creating a nuclear commission to deal with long-term costs all create pressure on the federal government to act. In conclusion, there has never been a plan B for long-term nuclear waste storage. The federal government was going to take care of it. Whatever happens at the federal level, Minnesota now has to have a plan B. Relying on the federal government to take care of this critical issue has not resulted in anything other than tremendous uncertainty, unacceptable risk, and lots of dry cask. Thank you for giving this opportunity.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. The next speaker is Danine Provenchar.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Danine Provenchar, and I am representing the West Metro Global Warming Action Group from the West Suburbs. My intent today with my testimony is to dispel some of the myths being used to market nuclear energy as clean, cheap, abundant, and safe, and that it results in no carbon footprint. The issue of nuclear power being used as an answer to fight global warming has led our organization into researching the pros and cons of nuclear energy. Please allow me to address some of our concerns. Number one, nuclear energy is not clean. Though the actual emissions of a nuclear power plant do not directly emit CO2, there is much concern about the toxicity of the spent fuel rods without any storage solutions. The byproduct of plutonium, which has a half-life of 376,000 years, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission website, which cannot be safely stored, nor does any country have a permanent storage solution at this time. Also, the presence of radioactive materials during the mining stages, producing uranium tailings that have sickened communities due to lack of proper cleanup and have contaminated their drinking wells, along with the potential hazards of transporting radioactive materials in all phases of nuclear manufacturing. As one of many examples, according to an April 2004 report by the General Accounting Office, the U.S. will spend in 2002 dollars over $7 billion through 2070 to clean up a former uranium enrichment plant in Pudaca, Kentucky. And our most recent example is the shutdown of the Vermont Yankee reactor by a vote of 26-4 by the Vermont Senate due to the toxic tritium leaks in their groundwater. Number two, Nuclear power has a greater carbon footprint than renewable energy. Based on an energy policy study by Professor Benjamin K. Sovacool, he states, it should be noted that nuclear power is not directly emitting greenhouse gas emissions, but rather that life cycle emissions occur through plant construction, operation, uranium mining and milling, and plant decommissioning. And the Oxford Research Group projects that if the percentage of world nuclear capacity remains what it is today, by 2050, nuclear power would generate as much carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour as comparable gas-fired power stations as the grade of available uranium ore decreases. Number three.
Ms. Provencher?
Yes.
We do have your comments here.
Okay.
Is there anything on here that you particularly want to point out to us?
But well,
I can read these.
It's not cheap. It's subsidized heavily by the taxpayers, including the Price-Anderson Act. Federal subsidies will reach over $145.4 billion. I'm sorry. Replacing the reactors would cost $1.4 trillion. Nuclear energy is not abundant. The United States only supplies 8% of the uranium used in U.S. reactors. And it's certainly not safe. Otherwise, we would not need the Price-Anderson Act. Nuclear power needs liability limits under such an act, and renewable energy does not. Also, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has much to say about the vulnerabilities and lack of security of nuclear power plants from acts of terrorism. And lastly, nuclear power is just not needed. The United States can meet 100% of its energy needs by renewable energy resources, as stated in the Scientific American magazine, November 2009 issue, and also Dr. Makajani's book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak, and I hope you will consider some of my facts in your decision and continue to uphold the moratorium on building any new nuclear power plants.
Thank you. I'm sorry that we had to shorten your remarks, but we're losing our committee to another committee that has already started. So any questions or comments for the speaker at this time? Okay, thank you. Senator Koch, anything that you want to add at this point?
Not at this hour, Madam Chair.
Okay. We will be laying the bill over then and then taking it back up again on Thursday. And this wasn't the most exciting show on Earth, apparently. We didn't use all of our tickets, so tickets will not be necessary on Thursday. Okay. Meeting is adjourned.